life has to go on, work has to go on. Let me welcome the members who are around, whilst others have gone out on oversight visit. Please don't get surprised or concerned that you are overpopulating, overwhelming us. It's because this is a committee week, and unfortunately some of us are doubling up with other committees. It's better during the period, even if it's a committee week, that you know, activities of other committees are here within Parliament, because people can juggle around at least and come over. But when it's oversight visits, they're all over the shore, Limpopo, North West, KZN, Eastern Cape, depending. But as I say, life has to go on, and if you look at the topic of today, it is just as important. In the energy sector, probably the tendency has been that, honourable members, we look into electricity, gas, oil, nuclear energy, and so forth, renewable energy. We are seized, and rightfully so, even get passionate about ensuring that there's security of supply of energy, accessibility, free basic electricity, I mean, rural energy. The story goes on. However, amongst all those things, there's one element that is just as fundamentally important, that is safety in energy. Safety from generation level or production and throughout wholesaling, distribution, and up to consumption. In fact, recently I picked up a report which I think was organized by my predecessor on the pilot that was driven by the department through Central Energy Fund on about 1,000 households on the paraffin. And it was very, very striking, you know, on things that the outcome of that report. I'm just making this preface to emphasize and highlight that you know, why is it that we're dealing with this? Why have we invited Eskom to take us through electricity safety? Why have we invited the Paraffin Safety Association, the LPG Safety Association, and trade unions as well? I see NUMSA and NUMSA Trust and Hope, your other colleagues, NUM, and chemicals, SIPAU are around. If not, please, if you could just take a few minutes and phone them. We need them. Just assure us that they'll be around. Because at the end of the day, we have lights here, and there are workers behind that who have, you know, who are facing dangers on a daily basis, you know. And even at home, there's also a lot of injuries and fatalities. But also on the positive side, there's a lot of education that's going on. So I have trust that Eskom, you're not just going to tell us about how much have you done in terms of ensuring that there's safety, but to what extent have you gone about integrating the workers, you know, with public education, if I may say so. The same with the other two associations, and the same with unions. It's not about just fighting for the rights of workers, it's about what contributions have those trade unions done. You know, even if it means pressurizing the associations, your ESCOMs, to ensure that there is public education, not just about the measures at work or the appliances. And, you know, as I'm talking, I think one of the members made a miss. I don't know how. Maybe we should have invited the Bureau of Standards as well, probably in future, to just tell us that to what extent are they, you know, engaging on safety of household appliances, on I mean, energy. I won't just say electricity, but on the overall, you know, household appliances that deal with energy. And I trust and hope that because this is a journey and at some stage we will have to take this matter up again. We definitely will invite them. And please, to everybody here, if there's any other institution, organization or group that you feel in future we should invite, you're welcome to forward that to me, because this was just a start, but we need to deal with safety in energy. I'm not just saying paraffin, because that's the one of the, you know, most popular or notorious because of what it does in the informal settlements, you know, in the poor households, you know. But even generally. So I trust and hope one of the members will take this area of safety in energy as an integral part of our work, both from a supply side, you know, those who produce, those who generate energy in different forms through different carriers, and also at consumption level, which is just as important. Having said that, and David, welcome everyone, and I don't see the department around, but they promised that they would be around. I don't know now. We'll have to ensure, because at the end of the day, department is part of the furniture. They should be here. We, honorable members, you notice that the nuclear energy is not part of the list, because we've had it before. NNR does come and talk to us and brief us. And very, very shortly, in the next third term, we will be inviting them again. So we felt that it's appropriate for now to give space to other sectors which have not been fully dealt with in the past. I hope that's acceptable at this stage. Moving forward then, can we get from the committee secretary, apologies?
Thank you, Chair. The following apologies, Honourable Tinto, who is on an oversight visit with the Portfolio Committee on Mining, Honourable Mayatula and Honourable Hadebe, who is on an oversight visit with the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training, Honourable Ferguson, who is in Brazil, and then also apologies from Honourable Matibela and Honourable Lucas, who is on sick leave, Chair. Those are the apologies, Chair.
Thank you very much, and I trust and hope the two members who are on sick leave, they recover as fast as possible. We need them back here in this committee. Shall I invite ESCOM now to take us through their briefing? One of the members, I thought by now the ICT people would have been able to sort out a hitch in the system. But because we've got documents, let's be productive with time and just use the documents for now. I trust and hope in the next few minutes the screens will start showing something better than a blue blank light. But they are working on it. The sound division is working on the script, on the system. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable.
Just make sure that introduce your team and other associations to do likewise, to introduce their team as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, We would like to thank the committee for this opportunity awarded us at ESCOM to come and share with you some of the challenges that we experience on a daily basis and what we are doing about it. My name is Tolofelo Molefe, Group Executive for Customer Services at ESCOM. With me today, I've got Alvi Lester, who is the Distribution Operating Unit Head in the Western Province, who is going to be leading us through the first part of the presentation. And we also have Mabue Mapaka, who is responsible for social marketing campaigns at ESCOM around safety issues, and he will take us through some of the education and information campaigns we have put in place with the public. And at this stage, I'd like to please hand over to Alvi Lester.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Chair, just if you go through slide one, you will see the ESCOM intent is very clear. ESCOM needs to provide a product that is safe, and part of our values is zero harm. That is zero harm to customers, employees, the environment, as well as members of the public. Now, in today's presentation, what we'd like to share with you is really just our campaign around safety, some of the initiatives internal and external to ESCOM, and then just highlight some of the areas that we are concerned about. And then as part of the information sharing, we also like to go through some of the campaigns in terms of educating the public and particularly the children. So if you go to slide four, which is the statistics, we've just looked at a three-year window from 2010 to 2012. And if you look at the public fatalities, at the end of 2012 financial year, that was ending at the end of March, we had 33 public fatalities. And we have differentiated the public fatalities. We've got what we call fatalities, which we measure in our sustainability index, which is really fatalities that are not related to criminal activity. So we don't include in that particular number if there was theft, or an attempted theft and therefore fatality due to that. But if you look at the very next line, Chair, which is members of the public, in terms of total fatalities, at the end of March, we had 74 fatalities. Injuries due to the product are 179 at the end of March. And these injuries vary in terms of type and seriousness. Chair, I'd like to move you to slide six first before I explain slide five, the pie chart. It's really just a makeup of what are the primary causes of the fatalities in ESCOM. And if you look at it, the bulk of it, 34%, is electrical contact. 18% of that is when objects move into a line. And I know it sounds quite vague, but let me explain. Sometimes we have farmers, and what they do is they're actually moving either material or equipment, and it actually contacts with our lines. We had an incident about 3 weeks ago in the Western Cape where we had a signage company that was removing signage in the airport industrial area, and individuals actually moved the scaffolding, which was mobile scaffolding, from one side of the road to the other, made contact with a cable, and that ended in a fatality. And that's what we refer to in terms of objects into lines. Then if you look at the other categories, we've got illegal connections, 15%, motor vehicle accidents, 15%, and mobile equipment into the line, also 15%. Mobile equipment typically are back actors, mainly construction equipment, but also light aircraft. Here on slide seven, if you look at the major causes of our fatalities, you'll see the bulk of it is direct electrical contact. And in that category, you're looking at a significant amount of illegal connections that actually increase the risk that you have for electrical contact. Then you have people who have connected themselves unsafely. Now, we differentiate illegal connections from an unsafe connection. Illegal connection is where there is no meter involved. The person is tapping directly off the ESCOM network. An unsafe connection, what typically happens is that there is a resident who has a meter in their house, but they are taking multi-plugs and supplying other residents who do not have electricity. And what happens is those connections run across roads and through public areas. It's not an illegal connection because
the person with the meter is effectively still paying for the electricity, but it's an unsafe connection because you've got live wire running through a public space. Okay, if we go to slide 8, if you look at the direct cause for this electrical contact, we do have areas where conductors are low-lying or actually lying on the ground, and this is mainly due to either poor maintenance, the environmental conditions, erosion. Sometimes we find that some of our poles are rotting and they collapse. We have storms, wind, foul fires, big risk to us, accidental damage. There's a motor vehicle accident and part of the network is damaged because they drive into the pole. And then obviously vandalism is also a big risk to us. In terms of our motor vehicle accidents, it's mainly where Eskom vehicles collide with either pedestrians or third-party vehicles. Now, when we look at our campaigns and where we want to focus our attention in terms of safety, there's really two areas for Eskom to focus on. One is external to Eskom, and the other one is internal to Eskom. Now, when we look externally, Chair, we look at all our customers, direct and indirect. We look at the industries that we support. We've got a big focus on school kids. We also take the time then to make sure that we participate in some of the governance committees at schools and speak to parents about safety. We have campaigns in the rural communities as well as in the urban communities. Whenever we do electrification in informal settlements, it is preceded. And then we have a post-electrification session for informal settlements as well. And we've got a strong relationship with the agricultural sector around safety, as well as with the construction sector. Internal to Eskom, we have our statutory requirements. So we have to and we have established safety, health, environment and quality committees in Eskom. And I also want to add that at our SHECs, nationally and in the provinces, the unions are well represented. In fact, they are members of those committees. They are also leaders in terms of some of our work groups for those committees. So under the SHECs, we have work groups that deal specifically with things like motor vehicle incidents. We have groups that deal with security. What we also have, Chair, is we have contractor forums at a minimum 4 times a year across the country in every province. There again, we also have focus on safety, contractor safety, and the employee safety. In fact, we had a launch last week in this province for what we call the Zero Harm campaign, which was focused on the contractors as well as the internal employees. Just some of the strategies that we undertake to share, slide 9, in the schools campaign. We focus on daycare centers, primary schools and high schools, and what we have tried to do is to have an impact in terms of the curriculum. We've in this particular province engaged with the Department of Education to see how we influence the curriculum for students, so that safety and electricity safety, and also in addition to that, we've tried to bring on our colleagues from the other SOEs and looked at things like water safety, environmental safety as well, but to try and get this inculcated into curriculums at schools. We have school visits. What we do is we invite every quarter, we try and invite at least 8 schools to Eskom. We take them through a complete day at Eskom. We explain to them the value chain in Eskom, but we spend about 3 hours explaining to them the risks and the value of electricity. And we use very simple examples of connecting plugs, what they do at home, how they heat things at home, etc. So the idea there is to try and get to as many schools as we can. In the long term, again, we'd like to see that we influence the curriculum of these schools. In terms of community engagement, on slide 11, we have set community forums that we actually attend, that we actually present at. We have what we call advocacy campaigns with particular drives around energy efficiency and zero harm is driven. What we do is we involve a number of internal stakeholders, our integrated demand management team, and my colleague Mabuli will speak about Operation Kandisa, as well as the 49ing campaign, which is the energy efficiency and savings campaign. We do also go on a what we call a knock and drop system, where we go around to houses and we actually hand out pamphlets, hand out promotional activity materials. We've had for the last 3 years in Eskom, in fact slightly longer, a campaign called Wiseman, and it's also been advertised on SABC, where we actually have a drive around tips around what not to do, and is in Yorka campaign as well. Every year, Chair, we have an electricity safety week, and I'm on slide 12 now. And what we try to do in the electricity safety week is we have lots of engagement, particularly with communities where we know that there are risks. And we identify these communities based on the statistics as well as some of the trends that we see. We go out and we visit schools during the safety week. We have outside broadcasts. And we have a number of advertising campaigns both on radio and TV over this period. And I think the intent here is over the Electricity Safety Week is just to heighten that awareness as part of our campaign throughout the year. Chair, on slide 13, with the agricultural sector, we have participated with agriculture, specifically in the training material that they require for both the people, the employees, as well as members of the agricultural sector. So we've gone on a campaign, particularly with farmers, to educate farm workers around the hazards of electricity and also how they use electricity in the agricultural sector. We also participate both in provincial and in national forums, again, with the intent of making sure people understand both the consequence as well as the impact of electricity. In the media, we have continuous campaigns where we deal with both radio and TV. We've done significant amount of interviews around both incidents, as well as some of the proactive measures that we're taking in Eskom. The biggest part of our work, Chair, is really in the engineering part of the business, and we have a very big reliance on some of our contractors. We also find that the biggest part of the customers that we have are actually also new developers, people that are wanting to put up new structures, whether that be housing or whether that be full developments. And what we've tried to do is we've tried to partner with these individuals to make sure they understand the Eskom value around zero harm. We've gone through a process with our contractors, particularly in the construction forums, and we spoke to labor about how do we make sure that from the Department of Labor that we can actually also include some of the Eskom initiatives as part of the construction regulations. We've got a campaign around Build Safe SA, where between ourselves and the construction industry, we're actually driving a campaign around not just constructing the house, but doing it in a manner that is actually done safely, both from an electrification as well as from a construction point of view. And we've hosted a number of seminars at both a provincial and at the national level. In terms of the motor vehicle instance, Chair, we have a number of campaigns that we undertake. We've got what we call OVC, onboard computing. All the Eskom vehicles are fitted with these machines. What we do is we check on the OVCs, speeds that we travel, rev range. We look at start stops. We also look at driver behavior. We've got a drive cam installed in all our vehicles as well. It alerts the supervisors and the managers if there is a behavior that is not suited, so harsh braking typically, swerving. It also indicates typically when people are not wearing their safety belts. So we've got a fairly extensive campaign when it comes to our vehicle chain. Our biggest concern is also making sure that our people are assessed correctly and trained correctly in terms of driving those machines, not just the cars, but also the operating machines that we have, and that they're authorized. Our statistics in Eskom, in terms of vehicle incidents, is that we've had a significant increase in number of vehicle incidents. Our biggest concern around that, Chair, is also we've put a lot of vehicles, a lot more vehicles on the road than we had previously. So our fleet has actually gone, so the risk is actually bigger to Eskom. So So the focus now for ESKIM is to try and make sure that our people are well trained and that we have all the processes in place to actually manage any type of incident. Chair, at this point, I'd like to hand over to my colleague Mabuwe to take us through Operation Kanyisa.
Thank you, Alvi. Morning, Chair. I think Alvi has already mentioned the work that we're doing in ESCOM around educating the public. But specifically, I want to talk about Operation Kanyisa. In his introduction, as we mentioned, that we are mandated and committed to providing reliable, safe electricity, and also educating the members of the public about legal, safe, and efficient use of this product. And what we actually found out in the work that we did in ESCOM around energy losses, or should I call it energy theft, was that actually links very directly with unsafe incidences that we've actually seen in a number of areas. So when we started working around energy loss management, we picked up the element of people not understanding how to use this product very safely. So we then came up with a campaign that we call Operation Kanyisa. So that specifically, at the beginning, it was targeting energy theft. But then we then said, this campaign must actually be an integrated approach, because you can't talk to somebody about electricity theft, for an example, in an informal settlement, somebody has connected themselves illegally. You talk to them about the fact that they're stealing and not necessarily deal with the issue that the fact that they that connection is unsafe, and it might just end up killing people. And whilst talking to them about that, some might say, look, we can't afford, the bills are too high. Then you bring in an element of energy efficiency. And others will steal cables here to go and connect elsewhere. So you can't talk about this electricity theft without necessarily talking about all these other elements that I just mentioned. So we then said the approach of Operation Kanyisa has actually been an integrated one that talks to theft, that talks to safety, that talks to energy efficiency. And we launched the campaign in October 2010. And then when we launched it, we also identified areas where we've actually seen a high number of unsafe incidences and also a high level of electricity theft. Then we went into those communities. We actually had about five areas that we've identified, and we had pilot activities in those areas. And in those areas, what we basically did was to identify what is it that is causing the community to do what they're doing. And we didn't want to go in there and antagonize the community. So we actually had an approach that says we need to work together with the community to come up with what we call joint problem solving. So the communities assist us in actually identifying what is it that needs to be done. What are their challenges? And then from an ESCOM side, we then come and say, what is it that we, from our side, can do to make sure that the community either gets what they need safely, efficiently, and much more economically. But then more and more we drive in the element of safety, because we realize we're actually losing a lot of children. And we said the vehicle that we will use, especially in these communities, it's more children, school children. You go to schools, talk to the kids, they go back home, they talk to their parents, and the message is actually very, very effective. In December last year, in these five areas that I'm talking about, we actually went and asked the school children and the communities in general to say, we've been talking to you about this Operation Kanyisa, these issues that we've picked up in the areas, and you've been coming back to us and say, this is what we need to do to resolve the issues. just play it back to us so that we can then see whether this message is actually was driven home and is successful in doing that. Very interesting, Chair. The school children came up with plays, came up with drama, poetry that talks to this message. And when you listened to those plays, you listened to those dramas and the poems that they actually presented to us, you could then see that the message was actually driven home. And we're hoping that we'll take this approach and actually drive it across the country, because we in those five areas where we piloted it, we believe it actually worked much, much effectively. So we'll take it across the country. But again, what we also did from an operation cancer perspective was not just to work in the communities that we've identified, but we actually worked nationally. You might have seen an advert that we've created either on radio, TV, or outdoor, where we actually we're driving the message to say electricity theft is actually killing the economy. Let's work together to make sure that we actually stop it and eradicate it. And we also ask the communities, ask the general public to report incidences so that we can then deal with them. And I must say, in the past 18 months that we've actually established this thing, we received over 3,000 calls, or what you call tip-offs, where people say, my neighbor is stealing, so-and-so is connected illegally, so-and-so is bypassing his meter. And then we've actually dealt with those. Some of them are in Eskom supply areas, some of them were in the municipal supply area. So we take the calls and then we direct them where they're supposed to be directed. And then that has been very, very successful. So basically what we're seeing is in the areas where we've worked around Operation Kanyisa, where we're seeing changes, but I think we are still at early stages. We want to drive this thing across the entire country, and hopefully we'll win in terms of changing people's behavior around electricity theft and basically illegal connection. What we've also done is in this presentation, Chair, was actually a presentation that we normally do. Alvis talked about in electrification areas, when you go and do electrification, we do what we call pre-electrification safety education. And then after we've electrified, before we switch on, we also then do a follow-up that is post-electrification safety education. In the presentation, you have, I think from slide 23, tips that we normally give to our customers before they actually start using the product, our product. And we've identified areas that are problematic, especially outside of the house and inside of the house. So the first few slides there after slide 23 talks about outside of the house, especially around overhead power lines and underground cables, mini subs and substations, where we're saying we've actually seen people climbing up pylons. For an example, if you look at slide 24, children climbing up the pylons, and basically the message that we're giving to them is to say that is unsafe, don't do that. People throwing stones at these things, and sometimes you hit those pylons and you have flashovers, and that can be very, very dangerous. It's a detailed chair. I don't know whether I should go through all of them, but basically this is the example that we use to educate people around electricity dangers. We also do the same for inside the house and say what is it that people should do in the house, or what is it that people shouldn't do in the house to make sure that they are safe. If you look from slide number 33, it talks about in the house and what are the sort of things that are good to do and what are the sort left that cable there, the way it's connected, the way it's actually stringed together, that just demonstrates to you that it is unsafe. And we say we should not do things like those. People pulling a plug, for an example, from the socket, the way they remove it, they just pull using the string, and that becomes dangerous. And we're saying we educate people not to do those type of things. In other environments, especially in informal settlements, you find people who are doing things that are really, really unsafe. For an example, you find people using a pressure stove, you know, the base of the pressure stove, and on top of it they put your coil that comes from your hot plate, and they connect that and either use it as a heater or they actually use it as a hot plate, and that is very dangerous, and it actually creates a lot of fires, especially in winter. That's where we actually see the major problems, because that's when people need heating. And these are the sort of things that we're picking up in our communities, in our environment, and in our customers. And basically, we're actually saying to them, let's be safe around this product. If we use it safely, this product is actually good. But if we use it unsafely, we don't use it in the right way, we will end up killing ourselves. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. You didn't introduce yourself.
Sorry, Chair. The name is Mabue Mapaka. I'm the Senior Manager, Energy Trading and Sales Forecasting in Group Customer Services in ESCO.
Thank you. Can we get the Barrison Safety Association then?
Thank you, Chair, and honorable members and everybody in the house. My name is Patrick Lunwamo Kulati. I'm the Managing Director of the Barrison Safety Association. And next to me is Glenn Turen. He's the General Manager. And then on my left here, I've got Deron Swart, the Senior Project Manager. And then we've got Ashley, and then Sumaya. Sumaya is a Research Officer, and Ashley is an intern from the U.S. And then we've got Noni, our financial director. We decided to have an outing at Parliament today. I'm going to be trying to be brief. I'll keep this presentation to 2 hours.
Don't worry, we still have all the energy.
Oh, you still have all the energy. Okay. I'm glad that you invited us to this meeting and to also to engage with other stakeholders like ESCOM, the Electric Gas Association, the unions, and so on. I'm hoping that after this meeting, we'll be able to collaborate more. The association was established in 1996. After the new government came into being, there was an arrangement between the Paraffin Safety Association with the petroleum industry around the question of what to do in informal settlements, specifically around ingestions of paraffin by children. And so the industry came together to set up an association. In fact, they started to do things individually, but that couldn't work out. They established the association in 1996, basically to eliminate and to ingestions and to educate people. But it became clear as the time went on that the problem was not just about ingestion. There were underlying problems around the stoves that were being used or the heaters or the appliances. Now, today, the problem is much, much bigger as the urban migration of people into urban areas is happening and the informal settlements are growing. But what we're also finding, if you just only do, we keep track of, in the media, of reports on energy incidents that happen. All you need to do is just to pick up a newspaper, read, and see what goes on. But what it's picking up is that it's no longer just the problem of the informal settlements now. The fires are taking down even formal housing. The city of Cape Town just released a press statement that showed about 1,500 fires that they attended to. Most of those fires happened in formal housing. So the problem is no longer confined to informal settlements. It's happening. And it's not just caused by paraffin. It's caused by other energies and sources of energies as well. So the problem that we're seeing is that it's bigger than just paraffin. And we keep these records. And in fact, when a fire happens, some of us just read it in the newspapers and we see it in the media, we leave it there. But we as the Paraffin Sales Association, we track it and go down to those communities to go into those houses to see what goes on. In fact, I'll invite you to go to our website this afternoon because I have a video here which I would have loved to show that shows exactly in graphic terms what happens when a fire happens in the home. In fact, in the slides here, a shack gets taken down in less than a minute. All of it burns down in less than a minute. And we track also the time, not only the time, but the temperature. In less than in a minute time, the temperature reached 398 degrees Celsius. Just to tell you the problem that happens in a home. So we keep this quite well. I don't know if you can see there, but we don't have. So I would invite you to go to our website and please look at this presentation, and it will blow your mind. We've identified that there are underlying problems, a lot of them, but we'll summarize them into three. One of them is poverty and unemployment. That is a fundamental problem that's taking place, where people have limited access to resources and the inability to invest in safer systems. You've got a lot of problems with unsupervised children, where parents have to go away and find and look for jobs or work. They don't have anyone looking after their children at home. Lots of overcrowding and all sorts of problems around poverty and unemployment. Housing designs that are badly put together. There are other systemic problems relating to the appliances that are used in the home. Many of those appliances are falling apart. They are unsafe, they do not meet any standards, and they are dangerous and illegal. And many people cannot afford to buy what they termed a safe one. They have to use that which they have. And the other problems relate to, even if you have standards, the inability of the state authorities sometimes to monitor the regulations and make sure that they are enforced. There's a huge problem around ingestion. For example, here I've got water, this water bottle, which is labeled very clearly and packaged. But you can use anything to go and buy paraffin. You can use this bottle, you can use a Coke bottle, and for children, they mistake it. And we've been calling for labeling and packaging of paraffin so that it's properly done, so that it people can actually know and see it for what it is. There are problems at the point of consumption. That's the third underlying causes. Informal housing made from combustible materials. You've got stuff hanging around the flame. I was in Joe Slovo's a week or so ago in a shack environment there, where you had children cooking on their own on a surface that was slanting like this. And you find that sometimes it's not on the paraffin stove, but there's an electricity stove there, but simply because of the way that it is, it's just like it's unsafe. But also, what we're finding is that the injuries are not coming from just flames only. They're coming, I think Gerard is going to tell you more about that, from what's inside the pot when it falls over. So it's no longer just the paraffin that's the problem. It's all the energy sources that we need to actually spend a lot of time, especially discussing among all the stakeholders involved, to say how do we do it as opposed to doing it in silos. Now, I've highlighted some of the impacts, so I'm not going to get into most of that. The death of people is a big problem. Injury and loss of economic opportunities, loss of property, absenteeism at work, impact on the you know, on the economy, a huge burden on the health system. We, you know, Professor Gordy of Red Cross Hospital, I mean, they have a slide there which shows the cost of keeping a child in hospital or a person in hospital. Yeah, it's huge. And all of that is absorbed by the public sector health system. It's a huge problem that we are facing in South Africa. And unfortunately, no one seems to be, in fact, let me say no one, I'm glad that the chair is picking it up. But it's not an issue that's out there. We see it in the media, and that's where we live it. And so, and we're calling as an association that there has to be a concerted effort around household energy safety, and I'm glad that this committee is taking a step around that. Loss of homes, loss of property, loss of all of these things. There are also psychological issues here. We have a colleague at work, her name is Sibongile. You're going to see another video there. Sibongile had a child, was cooking, and the paraffin stove just exploded while she was cooking. And she wanted to save her child, but she got burnt a huge part of her body. And she started, her story is just amazing in terms of its of its problems. But you must go onto our website and look at the second video. But what happened is that Sibongile says to us, if I had known what you paraffin safety people are teaching, like stop, drop, and go on, I would have been much better than I am today. And she, we have employed her now to be our champion to go around the country and around the communities to educate the people. But more importantly is the fact that she has been stigmatized. She has not been able to get jobs simply because of how she looks. And so we met her at one of our public meetings in Khayelitsha. And as we were inviting people to come and speak, she came up shy and stuttering. And we decided that she needed support, so we trained her to speak and to be confident. She now can speak well and talk. We wanted to bring her here, but she couldn't. So what I'm saying is that it's much more than just economy. It's about stigma. It's about psychology and all of those kind of things. So the problem is huge. We can't do the video now. All right. Thank you so much. We'll just show you the video briefly. Let's look at the first one.
The mother of three was busy with a simple task. Food for her baby when her pans and stove exploded, engulfing her in flames. Now she leads a team to educate others in informal settlements about the dangers of parenting.
Thinking about household energy differently.
planning department this week outlining the need to explore alternative energy options. Ellen Gardner, Eyewitness News, Cape Town.
All right, thank you. For those who couldn't watch this, you can actually watch it on our website at www.paraffinsafety.org. There's no Z A. We're prepared to engage in discussions around what we're saying to make sure that we all work together in this regard. But our work is focused on three areas: community engagement, similarly to what ESCOM is doing. We're involved in door-to-door campaigns. Here in Cape Town, we were in Philippi working there. We do trainer training. We have winter campaigns, which is interesting to hear ESCOM talking about a week, electricity week. It would be nice to actually combine together. We have a winter campaign where we spend the whole month of June and even more to actually raise awareness around not just paraffin safety, but household energy safety. We work in schools. We work in clinics, we have media campaigns, that's just in terms of community engagement. We're also involved with research and surveillance, and Deran, my colleague, is going to tell you more about that. We're involved with educational resource development. We're doing household energy surveys where we go into the homes to speak to the people there, to check their energy use patterns, to ask them about what their needs are. Thermal needs and everything like that. How are they using energy? And all of that, the costs that are involved. We also do fire and injury surveillance in hospitals to check what causes the injury, where on the body, the gender, the age, and all those kinds of things. We have a huge data of information. And we do this across energy sources, not just in paraffin, so that we can have, because in the country we don't have such a system. So as an association, we decided, let's play that role to provide that information. We also do appliance surveillance to check what people are using out there, gas stoves, two-plate stoves, paraffin stoves, all of that kind of stuff. And we're doing also lobbying and standards. We're working with the South African Bureau of Standards, the National Regulator for Combustible Certification, and so on. Another big thing that we did was that we had a series of summits in South Africa, that was a couple of years ago, where we brought your low-income household energy users to a number of cities across the country, of summits across the country, where people articulated their energy needs. And then at the national summit, there was a declaration, a paraffin users household energy summit declaration that was issued there. We gave it to the Department of Energy at the time. That is within your pack. You can also download it from our website. So basically, that's what we do in a broad stroke. And now Deran is going to come in and just drill down a bit more on some of the things that we're doing. For example, let me just talk about safety education. Between 2007 and 2011, we've trained over 400,000 people that went through our training system. We're training here government officials, health officials, health promoters, community development workers. We're training here in our community members, leaders, and all those kinds of people. So it's a huge thing that we'd like to extend also to workers and other people. We have developed a grade 7 curriculum, energy safety curriculum. We're still busy now working to make sure that it's piloted in schools. We're engaging with the Department of Education to make sure that what ESCOM was talking about in terms of curriculum, putting safety into curriculum, we've already designed a curriculum document. And so what I'm trying to say is that we're trying to do this as much as possible. We're partnering with a number of people, local and provincial government, SABS, the SABC, National Disaster Management Center in all the provinces and nationally, the Offices of Consumer Protection, National Consumer Forum, the oil companies, CSI departments. We're working here in the Western Cape with ESCOM and in other provinces as well. I think we are working with ESCOM. And so now I'm just going to hand over to my colleague, Deran, to just tell us a bit more about the research project that I was telling you about.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honourable members. The
the Paradigm Safety Association of Southern Africa tries very hard to be an evidence-based organization. So whatever we do, we try to measure. We do have limited resources, so we have to see that those resources are actually used efficiently and effectively. We do have a research department, and part of that research department, we do surveillance, as Lonwabo said. We do injury surveillance, as indicated on this on slide 14, where we have we're collecting data in about 8 participating institutions at the moment. Over 12,000 records are collected, have been collected already, in various hospitals across the country, Free Hospital in the Eastern Cape, as well as Dora Ndinza, Prince Bushiyeni Hospital, Inkosi Albert Luthuli, RK Khan in KZN, and right up into Mpumalanga, Bloemfontein, and Kimberley as well. And the reason why we started this a few years ago, because we know from the Medical Research Council's surveillance system on injury and mortality that burns is a big problem. It causes a lot of mortality. But that's just the tip of the iceberg that we're seeing reported in the MRC documents. The rest of the burden of injury is vast. And so we started this project to find out what's actually happening in hospitals, what sort of injuries, energy-related injuries are actually coming into hospitals. I'll be referring to some of the data later on. But if you go down to slide 16, this is actually a slide from the Domestic Use of Energy Conference held earlier this year, slides from the Department of Energy, which reports that 3.4 million households currently do not have access to electricity across South Africa. And it actually points to 1.2 million informal and 2.2 million formal houses that don't have access to electricity, and it's very unlikely that these houses will actually have access to electricity. So it was quite interesting because it actually mirrors what we are actually finding out from our research in communities. We've worked across the whole of the country in almost all the provinces, mainly in informal settlements and rural communities, entering over 12,200 houses and actually finding out what is happening in those houses. And we're talking about mostly the poorest of the poor in the country. From slide 18, you can actually see that two-thirds of our houses that we visited earn under 1,000 rand. So we are talking about the poorest of the poor. And in these houses, you can actually see that from slide 17 that for cooking, paraffin, you know, we're looking at almost 10,000 of those houses are using paraffin for cooking. Less than half of that number. Sorry?
Where and how are your slide numbers?
Oh, sorry. I'm on the slide that says energy use in South Africa. Apologies for not having the number. We actually thought that we will be referring to the screen, so we didn't put it on the slides. Are you with me? Okay. Energy use in South Africa. For cooking, paraffin is the energy source used mostly in the over 12,000 houses that we visited, followed by electricity and then wood. And if you look at heating, again, paraffin is used double, twice as often as electricity and wood. And then lighting, most people are using candles in the very indigent part of our population. I'm paging over to the next slide that says energy use and South Africa's poor. This was a study that we did with GTZ, the German funding government agency. And it actually shows that the poorer you are, the more you're actually spending on energy. It's quite unfortunate that we have this situation that those that are earning up to 1,500 rand a month are spending 26% of their income, monthly income, on energy, on their energy needs. So that's a quite an interesting fact that we have to bear in mind. Moving down to the next slide, energy-related fires in South Africa. We asked communities, the over 12,000 houses that we visited, has there been a fire in your home, and what actually caused that fire? You can see that 53% of the fires are actually caused by either the stove being knocked over and the stove exploding. So it points to the systemic problems that we have with energy provision and usage in South Africa, that the appliances that people are using are problematic. And then also 30% of the fires are actually caused by candles falling over. If you go to the next slide, energy-related injuries in South Africa. Here we looked at how many injuries are actually occurring in the hospitals that we've surveyed, and also which age categories are most prone to these injuries. Just bear in mind that the age categories, we had to split them up. Okay, we seem to have some action on the screens now. Not very clear, but if you look to the left-hand side of the horizontal axis, we have the young ages, less than 1 to 2, 3 to 4, 5 to 9. We had to split those age groups in that way because there are so many young children being injured under the age of 10, under the age of 5 even, that if we had to add those, put those bars on top of each other, it will actually, extend past the screen. So, sorry? No, this is all the injuries collected over 6 years. And this is the pattern that we are finding, that it's mostly children under the age of 5 that are being injured. The other categories are 5 years and even 10 years when you reach 25 to 34. So we're getting this. Yeah, sure.
Can I just add something there? That this kind of data helps us to design our interventions appropriately. It shows, for example, what age group needs a lot more resources in terms of our intervention. This research that we're doing helps us to design the kind of appropriate interventions because this information is useful to the extent to which we can use it to intervene in the proper way. Sorry, Dylan.
And I think it is useful even for the Department of Health to have a look at this information because we've actually worked with, let's say, Mpumalanga Health Promotion Department, and they look at the integrated management of child injuries, and they actually use our materials because they know that it's mostly children that are injured. So it actually directs the way interventions are developed and used in South Africa. If you go down to the next one, it says energy-related injuries in South Africa. Most of the injuries that we are seeing in hospitals are hot liquids falling on mainly children. We found that to be 38%. Flames causing injury, 18%. And ingestions, paraffin specific ingestions, 9%. And I'll come back to that. So this slide actually just points out that most injuries are hot water injuries that are presenting in hospitals. If you go to the next slide is labeled burn injuries in South Africa. This again points out that most of the children are presenting themselves in hospitals with burns. And if you look at the cause of these burns, as I said, it's not so clear on the slides, the printed version, but it's the darkest block is hot water. So
under the age of under age of one, it's hot water. 1 to 2, there's even more hot water burns in that graph. 3 to 4, 5 to 9, and then the light grey, it's flame burns. If you look at one of the questions that we actually used in the questionnaire at hospitals, what was the energy source that's actually implicated in the burn? It might be hot water, but what was the person using when that hot water was boiled? And we're finding that double the amount of burns are caused by electricity-related injuries than paraffin. Wood is lower down, candles, very few LPG-related injuries causing burns and coal. So here again, it just points out to the multiplicity of energy sources that are used in the home and the type of energy source that actually causes injury. Part of our research also looks at poison ingestions. It's quite a similar pattern emerges, that it's mainly children that ingest paraffin. We're looking at paraffin and any other ingestion, and it's quite startling to see that one chemical out of hundreds of chemicals in the home is actually featuring so highly. And this points again to what Lonwaba said about the lack of packaging, the lack of child-safe containers, child-safe, child-proof closures, proper labeling, proper containers. Most of the paraffin ingestions are occurring in the age group 1 to 2. As I said, it's one chemical versus hundreds of other chemicals that's featuring so highly from our research. I'll hand over to Lonwaba just to wrap up the presentation. Thanks.
Thank you, Dylan. Thank you, Chair, for the meeting. I'd like just to conclude by making a few proposals and concluding remarks. But just before I do that, I wanted just to indicate that as an association, we're in the process of changing our mandate and moving away from just focusing on paraffin safety to focusing on household energy safety in general. We want to do that in partnership with other players in the field who are already in that field, who are ensuring the safety of other energy sources. But we are making that change now to becoming a household energy safety, because we realize from research that it's no longer appropriate to just be narrowly focused. And so we're going to be reaching out to our colleagues out here to check what is that we can do together more. And then we have made a submission to the National Planning Commission, particularly about the need for a household energy safety policy for the country. And we've made that submission because we believe that we need it. It's very, very crucial that we have it. So that's one proposal that we're trying to make. The other proposal we're making is that we need to have buy-in and action by government departments that are relevant, in particular the Department of Energy, to make sure that there are projects that are being done on the ground, led by government in supporting of what we are doing, what the LPGAS Association is doing, Safety Association is doing, what ESCOM is doing, but there has to be a drive also by the government in this regard. We would like to call for a collaboration among the stakeholders, both in planning but also in the delivery of interventions. We'd like to encourage more enforcement of regulations and standards. The last issue that we want to highlight is that if those of us who are middle class, I guess all of us here are, if your house burns down, your insurance is going to send forensics people to come and check what happened. And they're going to check and even identify where the point of fire was. But because poor people are not insured and their houses burn down every now and then, there is no way, there's no one who actually checks what really caused the fire to be able to design a prevention strategy. And so there is a need for discussion around what do we do forensically to make sure that we get to the root of this. So those are some of the proposals that I would like to make, and would like to appreciate this opportunity to share again. Thanks.
Thanks very much. That was more than a mouthful, and I trust and hope even other associations are listening. Of course, I'll keep on reminding people this is the beginning of the journey, because there are a number of revelations here, far more than when the association approached me. Can we move then to the LPG Safety Association?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Energy. Welcome. My name is Dennis Harold. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the LP Gas Safety Association. I'd just like to thank the committee for this opportunity to do this presentation on safety in the LP gas industry. And I'd just like to say welcome to my other association colleagues and members present here. To my left is my colleague, Kevin Robertson. He's our communications manager. Fortunately or unfortunately, our team, we have a safety workshop tomorrow in Durban. So our team is busy preparing for that as well at this time. So if I can just start my presentation, and you'll just note on the first page, our slogan as the LP Gas Safety Association is, you know, safety is in the interest of a safer South Africa. In terms of the overview, just what I'm going to be covering is a brief background on the LP Gas Safety Association for those present that might not be familiar with us. Just a brief background on LP Gas. Then I'll be touching on why LP Gas, its application and uses, benefits, and then we'll move on to safety, regulations and standards, challenges affecting safety, and solutions, because I do believe there are solutions. And with that said, about 2 years ago, I did a visit to Brazil. There was an international gas conference. And one of the members of one of the Brazilian gas companies told me, he said, Dennis, you know, gas is very safe. You know, especially liquefied petroleum gas, it's very safe. There's a lot of measures that have been in place. It's an established energy source. But safety, you know, what is safety? And he was very clear that safety is communication, because water that you drink is safe, but it can also be unsafe to those that do not know how to swim. So teach a person how to swim, teach a person how all about water and what it can do and the hazards as well, and they won't drown. So I think it's very important. The LP Gas Safety Association, we were established in 1987. We're a non-profit organization, and we represent countries that are involved in the distribution, installation, hardware, and retailing of LP gas appliances. The primary aim of our association is to ensure the sustainable growth of liquefied petroleum gas industry through promoting safety and compliance with best business practices. We bring together companies involved in one, several, or all activities in the industry and develop long-term partnerships with local and international organizations and government organizations in order to ensure the safe and efficient use of liquefied petroleum gas. Now, what is LP gas, liquefied petroleum gas? It's energy in a bottle. It is versatile, fast, clean, powerful, portable, and safe. In some part of the world, they'll call the LP gas cylinder a bottle, but you know, it's a cylinder or a bottle. The name liquefied gas finds its origin in the possibility to obtain gases, propane and butane, at nominal temperature and atmospheric pressure. Only moderate pressure or refrigeration is required to convert them into liquid state. And in terms of that, LPG occupies 274 times less volume as a liquid than as a gas. As a consequence, LP gas is easy to transport and store, making it the most multi-purpose fuel. LPG is colorless and odorless, and it requires a stenching agent, and that then provides a smell, a very strong smell if there is a leak. And there's some properties of LPG that are very similar to water. It's denser than air, even in a vapor state. So in a vapor state, it does act like water. So there are a lot of safety requirements around liquefied petroleum gas for that reason. Now, why LP gas? LP gas is an exceptional energy source due to its origin, benefits, applications, and its industry. LP gas both comes from natural gas processes and the crude refining process. With an immediate global availability, environmental benefits, its natural byproduct origin, transportation flexibility, and diverse application, LPG plays a pivotal role in the transition towards a more secure and sustainable and competitive energy model. LPG is clean burning, sustainable and efficient fuel, and a vital source of energy for hundreds of millions of people throughout the world today. It is a multi-purpose energy with literally thousands of applications. It's portable and can be transported, stored, and used virtually anywhere in the world, and there are sufficient reserves to last for many decades. Now, if you look at those applications and uses, there are more than 1,000 applications of LP gas. Hundreds of million people currently use LPG and depend on it for in terms of these applications. In commercial businesses, and it's not just cooking, you know, the automotive industry uses it, welding, agriculture, there's a lot of uses. And industry, and in terms of heating process, transportation, farming, power generation, a lot of forklifts are actually LPG-powered, and LPG is used in auto gas extensively in quite a few European countries. Currently in South Africa, Gauteng, through a project launched by Sasol in collaboration with the Department of Transport and the Central Energy Fund, have done a taxi conversion program. I think they've converted close to 400 taxis, which are running dual fuel, LPG and petrol, and they're doing fuel emission testing to look at the carbon savings there. And the statistics so far have shown very good carbon reduction in the region of around 30%. So only LPG can serve such a wide variety of uses. And these are just a few examples. Cooking fuel, for example, in a family in South Africa, or a community kitchen in India. Refrigeration for a shop owner in Brazil. Auto gas for taxis in Tokyo. Welding for car manufacturers. Heat for a family home in Canada. And LPG even powers the Olympic torch as we're approaching the Olympics. That's why it is referred to as the world's most multi-purpose energy. And so if you look at the benefits, once again, it's clean burning, sufficient, sustainable and efficient fuel, and is a vital source of energy for millions of people. There's a bit of a repetition. And I just want to stress, for example, the facts and figures, because when you look at lower greenhouse gas emissions, compared to petrol, diesel, and electricity, on an energy equivalent basis. For example, in India, LPG emits 60% fewer greenhouse gases than electric coil cookertops and 50% fewer emissions than some biomass stoves and 90% fewer greenhouse gases than kerosene stoves. And it was interesting, if you look at New Delhi, they've actually managed to transform that city. A few years ago, it was small grid. And if you go there now, because they've got some auto gas initiatives and they've got some energy efficiency and alternative energy programs running, the city is looking actually very smog-free. So there's some huge achievements that have been gained there in India. Now, just looking at the LP gas distribution chain, and it's just a very simplistic overview of the distribution chain, but it's just to point out how LPG is distributed in South Africa and in other countries in the world. You have manufacture and import of LPG. That, you know, then is provided to wholesalers. Those wholesalers through the distribution channels then provide that to retailers. And then from a retail perspective, that goes to your domestic user, commercial user, and industrial user. And some industrial users go through wholesale channels as well because they're bulk users. But in terms of the LP gas distribution, maybe in bulk or in cylinders, depending on many considerations such as application, scale of use, and consumer preference, the distribution infrastructure will include bulk depots, cylinder filling plants. At all stages of distribution, safety is of paramount importance. Okay. Now, moving on to the core focus of today's presentation, which is safety. LP gas is potentially hazardous. You know, yes, we do agree. From the point of production until it has been safely used and the combustion products have been properly disposed of, every uncontrolled release is a hazardous event and should receive urgent attention, which they do when they do occur. The principal potential hazard with LP gas is fire and explosion. LP gas containers should be readily identifiable as such. Consumers should be given safety information and having been informed should exercise reasonable care in handling and use. And I will expand on this further as we go through the presentation. Good appliance and installation standards are essential for safety. And I've just provided a link, worldofexceptionalenergy.com. We are a member of the World LP Gas Association, who are currently in Brazil launching a cooking program that's dealing with household emissions, reduction of household emissions, in conjunction with the World Health Organization. And Worldwide Exceptional Energy is a resource that's been provided. There's a lot of documentation on that website around every aspect of liquefied petroleum gas, auto gas, all its uses, carbon emission data, etc. It's all on that website. Now, another aspect that we tend to ignore when it comes to safety, you know, we tend to look at statistics in terms of burns and the other statistics that have been presented. We haven't concentrated much on statistics in our presentation because the organizations that we interface with, especially going up the channel, including your, you know, fire departments, local authorities, staff, disaster management at the coalface, also gain their own statistics. But we also feel there's other statutory bodies that could assist, especially when it comes to these form of statistics, like Statistics SA through the Statistics Act, that maybe they could facilitate a process of gathering statistical data on household safety, which would be of benefit. But coming back to that, one aspect that we tend to ignore is the health, because we, in terms of the LP gas industry, we look at both. We look at health and safety. And when you look at from the health perspective, burning biomass as a cooking fuel accounts for more than 2 million deaths and 41 million serious industries, serious diseases every year. Okay, this is a global statistic. It's been provided by the World LP Gas Association through the World Health Organization. In low-income countries, more than half of all lower respiratory infection deaths associated with indoor air pollution occur among children under the age of 5. Okay. Respiratory diseases from indoor air pollution contribute to more deaths each year than HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. Indoor air pollution is a serious problem, especially when you look. We also drive a winter campaign and with certain stakeholders to promote safety around winter because people are indoors in winter and obviously either heating or cooking. And in that environment, there's a tendency to block every single portal, window, form of ventilation to ensure, you know, maximum heating. But at the same time, there's that lack of knowledge and understanding that the people are actually going to cause themselves respiratory harm, and it's not a safe environment. Now, in terms of the LP gas industry, let's look at safety regulations and standards, which we find very important. The LP gas industry is regulated in terms of safety and business practices. On the one hand, in terms of health and safety, we've got the Department of Labor. And through that, we have the Occupational Health and Safety Act, which has put in place the pressure equipment regulations or incorporated the pressure equipment regulations, which incorporates the South African national standards. And we also agree with the chair, in terms of other participants. For example, the South African Bureau of Standards, our organisation, we have a memorandum of understanding with the South African Bureau of Standards, and we participate in the SAF committees and in the assistance of drafting the national standards around safety. And then from that, that leads to compliance and enforcement, and then prohibition and prosecution. And it's very important to understand this, because the Occupational Health and Safety Act, a lot of people believe that it is only for occupational injuries, and it's not. The Occupational Health and Safety Act requires businesses that are providing goods and services to anybody in the country to do so according to the standards and norms and such that are incorporated into those regulations. So, for example, your electricity. Engineers or installers must be registered with the body mandated by the chief inspector, and on and compliant, and when they do an electrical installation, for example, they have to issue a certificate of conformity to the electrical requirements and electrical regulations. So that starts to fine stream that industry to ensure that the end user and consumer, whether they're domestic, commercial, industrial, is getting their system electrical installation done conforming to the standards. And it's the very same thing for liquefied petroleum gas. In terms of our standards, we have to have competent gas practitioners, installers that are registered. There's a body that governs them. They have a code of conduct, which I will be touching on later. This fine streams the industry and promotes safety at all avenues, right down into the home. In terms of business practices, we have the Department of Energy, who's a major stakeholder and role player. And for us, it's through the Petroleum Products Act, where there are regulations in terms of the manufacturing and wholesaling of petroleum products. And then there's licensing conditions. Within these license conditions are health and safety requirements. And then the compliance and enforcement and prohibition and prosecution. Now, just to touch on some of the safety regulations and standards that are particular to the LP gas industry and that are current and established and published through the South African Bureau of Standards. In terms of cylinders and valves, we have the South African National Standard 10019. This is for transportable containers. It's the basic design, manufacture, and use in South Africa. We have the same thing for cylinder shutoff valves. And then moving on to regulator hoses and appliances, we have South African national standards that govern, once again, the basic design, manufacture, use, and maintenance. And these design standards go, once again, from domestic, commercial, and industrial applications to ensure that there's consistency in terms of that. And these regulations and standards also follow the World Trade Organization guidelines. So to enable, to ensure that any design parameters and so forth are in line with international best practice and encourages trade as well. We import a considerable amount of cylinders into South Africa, but there is local manufacture as well. I believe there's two local manufacturers. And then once again, looking at LP gas installations, we have a national standard there that is applicable to domestic, commercial, industrial, filling sites, mobile units, transportation, auto gas forklifts, mobile filling stations, and a few other applications. And this guides industry and provides parameters within which they can operate safely. Now, in that framework of all these safety requirements and South African national safety standards, we still do have challenges affecting safety within the LP gas industry. And there are a number of practices that affect safety in the LP gas industry. It's not LP gas itself that is a problem. I think we've also heard from the other organizations that awareness and education and compliance is very important. So if we look from the LP gas perspective, illegal cylinder acquisition, right? And this is basically where the companies that are operating in South Africa commercially and providing gas through their cylinders are having their cylinders hijacked or illegally acquired, and they go off to a site and get filled, and they have no control over that process. And the South African standards require that the cylinders are maintained, inspected, periodic inspection. Every time they're filled, there's requirements, and this is robbing those companies of that opportunity to do that. But at the end of the day, when something goes wrong, they are in the firing line because it's their products. The cylinders are branded in with their brands, and they have to account for it. So it's a very difficult situation. But it also leads to cross-border migration of these exchanged deposit-based cylinders. And you find these cylinders leave the country and maybe only either never return or maybe return years later, mal-maintained, and then pose a risk to end users. And it is a problem that we are trying to tackle with other state bodies, for example, SARS and Customs port control. The other challenge affecting our industry is illegal filling of LP gas cylinders due to this illegal acquisition of the cylinders. And there's two aspects that are pertinent. There's, first of all, the underfilling of LP gas cylinders. But I'd say 2 years ago now, the Department of Energy, in its move to make LP gas more accessible to especially residential or domestic users, regulated the retail price of LP gas. And with that, it's obviously important that the gas cylinders are filled correctly, and you know consumers are receiving what they're paying for. And obviously, this infringes on the trade metrology regulations. The second aspect, which is more core to safety, is the overfilling of LP gas cylinders. Obviously, the LPG in its liquid state is compressed, and within an LP gas cylinder, there has to be a vapor space. That vapor space is very important to cater for expansion or changes in ambient temperature. Without that vapor space, the cylinder will rupture, and it is a problem because you're looking at a stored LP gas liquid that's going to expand 274 times into vapor. So it's a huge risk. And I'll show some examples of what happens when an LP gas cylinder is overfilled and illegally filled. Then we move on to illegal installations. And this results in injury and damage to property. And generally, the installations that we're talking about are in your standard residential areas, commercial environments, and moving into, even into semi-industrial environments, where there's a bulk storage and then there's reticulation of gas pipelines into either a restaurant or a home and so forth. And that's done by somebody who's not competent. And we have had cases. There's not a lot, but we have had cases because there are steps and measures that have been taken to eradicate this out of the industry, which I will be covering as well. But it does pose a problem in terms of safety. And then we have illegal appliances and equipment. Okay, and with the assistance of the South African Bureau of Standards and under mandate from the Department of Labor, we've managed to establish a safe appliance scheme to ensure that all imported gas products comply to the South African national standards. And it also assists local manufacturing industry because our standards are also aligned with the ISO standards. So when any company is manufacturing local gas appliances for export, it's from a compliance perspective and a trade perspective, they then also meet the international requirements. To continue with the challenges, overstorage of cylinders. You find in cases certain players in the industry are not conforming to the requirements. The local authorities set the requirements for how much gas can be stored, whether it's in a domestic property, commercial property, or an industrial site. Generally, in commercial and industrial sites, a local authority approval is required. Plans are submitted, so in case of any incident, the local authorities can respond and they know what is stored there, how much gas, etc. So you have all the storage of gas cylinders. And unbeknownst to some, an empty gas cylinder is more dangerous than a full gas cylinder because there's always residual gas. And in a vapor state, LP gas is combustible. In a liquid state, it's not. So this poses a huge danger to people in facilities. And then proliferation of illegal retailers. With, I guess, the challenges that we're met with in the South African context when it comes to energy and our energy mix and sources of energy, as well as the demand placed on electricity, we are finding more people coming into the LP gas sector. Obviously, looking for opportunities to do business and so forth. But the safety requirements are often misunderstood. Some companies view this as a barrier to entry into the industry, but it's causing a huge problem. And this leads to illegal retailers finning any cylinder. They just get hold of any cylinder, stock up their yard, and they start to fill, unbeknownst to the owners of those cylinders. It leads to lack of maintenance of the cylinders, because through that, without understanding the safety requirements, there's a lack of knowledge, the proper filling processes, etc. And once again, it causes an unsafe environment. And I think touching on this last point, which is lack of citizen safety education, this is a broader concept. We have engaged the Department of Education, and we're in the process of doing a memorandum of understanding with them in terms of distributing LP gas safety material to the schools. We are always governed by resources, but we feel that some of the state organizations are resourced, and we've provided, for example, posters and materials to the Department of Education. We've done some inspections as well of a number of schools in Gauteng, through the Gauteng school feeding scheme, where a lot of schools switched to LPG for their basic cooking needs. So that was a good process. But we still feel, when it comes to lack of citizen safety education, that we're talking about school curriculum. Because at that level, when children go through school, leave school, and go into the business environment, to understand energy and safety and household safety at that level is very, very important. So education on safe use of LPG and other sources of energy is lacking when it comes to school curriculum. Fear of using cleaner, more efficient products, and you know that's the result. It's causing fear of using alternative products. And it can lead to potential misuse of LPG due to lack of understanding, turning an LP gas cylinder sideways or upside down, and so forth. Now, just moving on to the next page where you can look at examples. The first example, if you look at this, this is a site. It's a multi-cylinder site. There's a lot of cylinders in this filling site. And of multi-brands, you might not pick it up in the presentation, but there's a whole lot of different colors and brands. They're illegally stacked right against the filling equipment. There we go. And the cylinders could be underfilled or overfilled. They could be a mixture of empty and full cylinders. It's really completely illegal. And this is one of the sites that we did an inspection with the Department of Labor and served a prohibition and tried to get the company to institute corrective action. But this site is evident of a proliferation of illegal retailing, where the owner of the site has no permission from any of those companies to distribute their product. The second example, moving on to the next slide, is an example of the result of an illegally or overfilled LPG cylinder. Okay, and on the top picture, as you can see, the cylinder's ruptured. Okay, because there was too much stress in that cylinder. Okay, and that's the damage. The picture just below that is the damage that's caused, and that was a home in Hartbeespoort where we did an inspection of. There was no injuries. Generally, a lot of the incidents we've attended to, there haven't been any fatalities. And in our statistics for this year, there haven't been any fatalities relating to LPG. There's just been damage to property. So moving on to the next photo is a factory. Oh, sorry. It's just a factory that also had LPG stored on the premises, and the cylinder was also overfilled. And due to ambient temperature, it ruptured and it caused that damage. There was other flammable products on site as well. And then the last picture is also a home, once again, an overfilled cylinder, and it caused that damage. And generally with the overfilled cylinders, it's a very quick process. They receive these cylinders as soon as you connect it, gas stops, as soon as you open the valve, there's too much pressure in the cylinder. And generally what people do is they evacuate that gas appliance out of the house, and then it blows up, it explodes. Solutions. There are solutions. Solutions to reduce illegal cylinder acquisition. Proper recognition of cylinder ownerships within cylinder ownership within the regulations. It's very important, because what we have at the moment is the gas industry. The industry players are doing a lot in terms of trying to ensure compliance, and they're taking their own kind of civil claims against companies that are abusing their products or illegally filling their products that's causing this level of damage. But they're finding it very difficult to get criminal action or criminal sanction against these type of companies. So something has to be reviewed in terms of the regulations. Tight control at country borders, very important, because it's not only cylinders that migrate out of South Africa and reduce the stock that's available for South Africans. It's also cylinders that are not to the South African specification that might enter the country illegally through the borders. And it's very important because the cylinders in South Africa have a very special requirement, and it's called normalization. And the process of normalization is a heat treatment process that we require, because as you saw in that picture, that cylinder, after rupturing, was actually also in a fire, but it didn't explode. And that's because the cylinder is normalized. Normally, when you see a cylinder, it just ruptures. And what that does is it causes a bleddy. So there's not a lot of... It's a compression explosion which blows itself out. It's still very dangerous, but that is the result of the normalization process. A cylinder that is not normalized can explode and turn into shrapnel. So that's why we have the very special requirement in South Africa. All the cylinders are normalized. Another requirement that has been instituted by industry and even written into the South African National Standards for your valves is a pressure release valve. So we have a pressure release valve where we've seen cases of LP gas cylinders that have been involved in shack fires in the low income housing environment that haven't blevied. They've been caught in the fire. They weren't the cause of the fire. They haven't blevied because the pressure release valve releases LPG periodically. And it also assists the local authority and fire departments, because if they see this flame that periodically bursts up and down, they know where to concentrate their firefighting equipment for their safety as well. And the local authority has also participated in these committee meetings in terms of adding those type of safety accessories in terms of the LP gas industry. So it's been a very good process. So another solution to reduce illegal filling of LP gas cylinders, the monitoring and auditing of the distribution chain, and there's a number of parties that are required in terms of this, which I will get to. There's a slide that indicates that. Regular inspections of calibration and weighing equipment, and I believe this is the mandate or jurisdiction of the NRCS, or the National Regulator for Compulsory Specification. I think last year we interfaced with them, and they did do a series of inspections in terms of LP gas filling equipment, because there are weights that have to be assigned and so forth to ensure that the proper LP gas is being filled. Registration of filling personnel in terms of pressure equipment regulations. Currently, the Department of Labor has mandated a body called the South African Qualification and Certification Committee for Gas. It includes all gases, not just liquefied petroleum gas. It includes natural gas, compressed gases, aircon and refrigerated gases. And this particularly deals with installers and engineers and so forth. But we feel, and we've been having meetings with the Department of Labor, that the actual filling personnel should also be registered. Very similar to what happens with the fire hydrants. And because fire hydrants are very important safety accessories, and through the SHUCC fire, anyone operating fire equipment has to be registered with SHUCC fire, and anybody filling or maintaining those fire hydrants. So we feel that's an important solution in terms of reducing illegal fuel filling. Licensing of LPG filling sites in terms of the Petroleum Products Act. And I think one aspect that we've been discussing with the Department of Energy is the fact that the introduction of a retail price regulation without there being any retail licensing. So when it comes to LPG, it seems that anybody can retail it. Obviously, you must find an appropriate wholesaler and so forth, but there's no retail licensing, and it is a hazardous substance. Regular training and skill development on proper filling procedures by the LPG gas industry. This is one thing that we have endeavored to do, and we do consistently year upon year. We provide training to the industry in terms of LPG gas filling and so forth, and we train according to the South African national standards and through the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Now, moving to the other solutions, steps taken to reduce illegal installations. And like I've mentioned, there is the requirement, and the SAQCC gas has been established, and it does seem to be working very well. A lot of gas practitioners are being registered and are complying to the South African national standards and doing it safe installation and safe work. The requirement for the issuing of the certificate of conformity, we now have the gas certificate of conformity. So for all LP gas installations, whether domestic, commercial, industrial, agricultural, have a certificate issued to ensure compliance to the safety requirements. Regular inspection of installers. We have regular inspection of installers. This is done in conjunction with the Department of Labor inspectors. And there is an installer code of good practice, which then means that SAQCC gas can institute disciplinary action in terms of non-compliance if installers are not practicing according to the code. Steps taken to reduce illegal appliance and equipment. There's requirement for verification of LP gas equipment and appliances under the Pressure Equipment Regulation. It's regulation number 5. The LP Gas Safety Association have established the Safe Appliance Scheme under mandate from the Department of Labor. And I will touch on that. If some members, if you go to some major retail stores or gas dealerships and so forth, a lot of products actually are marked safe appliance, which means that product has been tested by an accredited test body, accredited through the SANAS, and it obviously complies with the standard. That doesn't take away the fact that you can't cater for latent defects and things like that, but it means that the manufacturing process is conforming to the standards. Inspection and monitoring, we do that. And we've had industry participation. Industry is participating well because all of the companies that are either importing products or manufacturing products want to ensure that compliance, when they come across products that are non-conforming, it's reported, and we follow up and do checks and so forth. And then you have your enforcement and prohibition, which is done between the LP Gas Safety Association and the Department of Labor. And looking at solutions to manage over-storage of cylinders, I think one aspect that is very important, especially when you look more at the low-income areas, is that they're very densely populated, you know, and when we look at equivalents, so for example in Brazil you have the equivalent of your favelas, they have proper designated storage areas for the storage of particularly LPG, but other flammable substances, which are maybe located on the periphery in an environment that's safe and adheres to all of the requirements. And I think if there's proper designation of storage areas, that would really assist in terms of safety, rather than finding LP gas being stored in those areas, you know, which is very dangerous. You've seen what one cylinder can do if it buries. And I think additional to that is obviously we do applaud the government's what it's doing in terms of housing and RDP and the development processes, because a lot of the low-income areas are informal, and we do want to see that formalization happening, and it must happen with the trade as well, must formalize. Regular on-site monitoring. It does assist ensuring that there's no overstorage of cylinders, and which you've seen in that.
Good ground up.
Okay, thank you. And then if you look at solutions to, I think we've touched on the proliferation of illegal retailers, and the solutions to tackle safety and education, I've also touched on that. If I just want to go onto that slide, and then I'll wrap up very quickly with one more slide. The key role players, if we move to one more slide after this, please. It's just a site called Key Role Players. You'll see in terms of this, the key role players to safety is the customer, the local authorities, national authorities, industry associations, LP gas suppliers and marketers, appliance manufacturing importers, equipment manufacturing importer, installers. I think it's a combined effort by everybody that's participating in the industry to ensure and safety. And if we just move to the final slide, LP Gas Safety's commitment to safety, association's commit. Through a number of committees, the association managed several schemes to ensure the safe use of LP gas in South Africa. We've got the Safe Appliance Scheme, we've got the registered LP gas installers, we've got the approved cylinder scheme, we've got the LP, we have LP gas education and training, and then we have the qualified LP gas dealer network. And all of these primary aim is to ensure the safe and efficient use of LP gas in South Africa in the best interest of safety in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Herold. That was much than a mouthful. But it's helpful because LPG is not an area that's well known, but please, in future, if you could just stick to your area, because once you start comparing yourself a lot with others, there's a risk of having that interpreted as being, you know, a competitive plant. just bear that in mind in future, because we'll be definitely working together in future. Can I suggest a 10-minute break? We've been at it for long, and then thereafter we'll have Nomsa. I see in the register there's a Mr. Olifir, if you could come forward during the break. Let's take a 10-minute break, please.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Good morning to members of the committee. I just want to make a very quick apology on behalf of the General Secretary of NUMSA. He's away, in fact, he's in Denmark at the launch of a new global union. And I also want to apologize on behalf of our National Health and Safety Coordinator. He's busy at a workshop with some of our colleagues from Germany, so he couldn't make it. The presentation that we have here, and I'm going to make an oral presentation on behalf of NUMSA. It's a very short presentation. It'll probably be under 10 minutes. We were allocated 10 minutes and probably under that. But it's a short presentation, and we want to share some of our experiences with you. The first thing is that we're very happy that the committee, that the Portfolio Committee on Energy, has extended its scope of work to cover health and safety issues. I think this is something that's been missing. We've normally looked at policy issues around energy. We never really look at the health and safety aspect, and I think this is important because it is of public interest. What I want to do is this, and what I want to share with you is that the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa covers two, there are two sectors that we cover, and sometimes there is an overemphasis on the energy sector. Now, it's true we organize workers in Eskom, and we have a stake and interest, and a vested interest, of course, for these workers who are organized and who are employed in the energy sector. But over and above that, and sometimes this is missing in the equation, is that we have workers in the filling stations, And sometimes there's a tendency not to look at the filling stations as, you know, as sites of energy. And this is an area where, and I think this is what I want to do in this presentation, is firstly to highlight the problems that we have with filling stations. This, in fact, with workers in Eskom and the bigger industries and the more organized sectors, it's less of a problem. Well, I wouldn't say it's not a problem, but it's less of a problem, and it's much more easier to organize in those sectors and to take up issues around health and safety. But in filling stations, even though they are organized in constituted bargaining councils, there are problems. And I just want to highlight some of these problems with the filling stations before I touch on Eskom and energy. With the filling stations, there are a number of associated risks that come with filling stations. And you'll find that the huge problems that we have in the forecourt. The forecourt is the area where you are actually dispensing, filling petrol in cars. The associated risk isn't just about filling petrol. It's about also the use of other chemicals that the garages use. They don't just use, it's not just a matter of filling petrol and dispensing petrol. There are chemicals that they use and chemical agents that they use in car washing the car, because filling stations aren't just there to fill petrol now. They're multifunctional sites. They do car washing. They have workshops. They have mechanical workshops. They have panel beating workshops. So there's a whole lot of activity, other work activity associated with filling stations, and each of them have their own kind of problems, but they're all in some ways exposed to the use of chemicals. They're exposed to the use of electrical equipment. So there's a whole lot of associated risks that come with filling stations. And these are sometimes, and many times these are overlooked. I mean, they're not really, to get a health inspector, for instance, to go to a filling station sometimes is really difficult. The bigger industries, of course, they are more organized, and I think Eskom's presentation covered that. They have a very elaborate system, the compliance with the health, the Occupational Health and Safety Act and so on. It's very different in some of the filling stations. One, our workers work very long hours. I think in a number of the smaller stations, which you'd find as you leave the cities, you start going down to smaller filling stations as you leave the cities, you find that workers work very long hours. They don't really have any protective clothing. So there's the risk of being tired. And the construction and design of these garages, now while this is meant to be regulated, is that sometimes you find that it's very tight, there isn't enough space for vehicles, so there's, for vehicles entering the garage and then beginning to exit from the garage. These very tight spaces, and all these just actually tend to compound the problem. So what NUMSA would like is that if we look at the health and safety aspect with energy, and I think we must extend this to cover, and it does in some ways touch on chemicals, then I think in the chemical industry, then we must also look at petroleum, and not just the manufacturers and the manufacturers of petroleum, like the engine at Caltech and so on, but we must filter this down and look at the actual filling stations that dispense with petrol and add in the use of other chemicals. The issues with Eskom, now, I think Eskom's given us a lot of statistics. I couldn't, and it would be very difficult for me to verify some of those statistics in the absence of information from our own National Health and Safety Coordinator. The one problem is this, is that I only got hold of him on Monday, and he was unable to actually give me this information. But what I can say is this, is that The kind of problems that we have it covers, and I think it does cover some of the areas that Eskom has touched on. One is the fact that, well, we have workers that are working in, the construction, operation, maintenance of high, low voltage electrical equipment, and I think Eskom pointed out that, look, a lot of the there's a much higher incidence of accidents because of the the huge area that they have to cover and transporting workers and equipment from one side to the other. And so vehicle accidents and contact with electrical equipment. And that is an area that we can work on. And I think we have health and safety. Our shop stewards are involved in health and safety committees. And I think it's like I said, it's less problematic to attend to these issues in huge industries. The other area, and this is also not covered to some extent, is that coming from ESCOM, we also organize workers in industries, but also in what we call the intensive energy users group. And I haven't got a sense that this is, that there's any reference to that, or whether the portfolio committee intends to actually look at the intensive energy users group. That would include the foundries and the smelteries and so on. I think those, it's very important that we actually include them as well, because they're all big guzzlers of energy, and we have a number of fatalities in these industries. So I think we have to take it and extend it beyond just ESCOM. The issue, and this is another issue which is of concern to us, and I think it's been raised here, is the question of illegal connections. Now, the thing about illegal connections is that I'm aware, and I think ESCOM has gone to some extent to explain the campaign that they have against illegal connections and the education programs and so on. But we aren't really going to win the war against illegal connections, because the problem here is a larger problem. It's a problem, and I think it's linked to our social, political conditions, our economic conditions. It's linked to the issues of poverty and unemployment. So illegal connections and winning the war against illegal connections is going to be a very challenging one. One thing that one should consider, maybe the portfolio committee should look into this as well, is that the issue of increasing the amount of free basic electricity, so that we minimize and we try to minimize the extent to which people resort to illegal connections. I must say is that, and I think this has been of great concern to the union, is that the issue of, when it comes to free, the provision of free basic services, and the issue of water and electricity, which is obviously being dealt with here, is that it's also a political issue, and we're not going to sort this out. It's one thing to say we've made so many connections and so many homes are now connected to the grid, but there are a number of disconnections at the same time. So we might increase the number of people having access to electricity, but unless we make that electricity affordable, we are going to find ourselves at the mercy of illegal, those who are resorting to illegal connections. So we the union strongly believes that this is an issue that has to be addressed, but we can't just look at it in very narrow terms. It has to be looked at much more broadly than just simply a campaign to stop illegal connections. The last point that I want to make is that the union, well, one is that we, like I said, we welcome the fact that the portfolio committee has now extended the scope of its work to cover electricity. And as a union, we want to assure this committee that we will work with all social partners. We think the issues of health and safety in the energy sector, as well as in all the other associated sectors, is very, very important. We need to create healthy and safe environment, not just for our workers, but for the general the general public in this country. So NUMSA is willing and open to work with social partners, and I think to some extent we are doing that. But the first time for us that we've heard presentations from, for instance, from the liquefied gas and from the association representing paraffin, those that have to use paraffin. And I think from our side, we found it very interesting. We think it's very informative. And we think we can, and perhaps there is a base and possibilities for actually working together on some of these things. And I think this is the kind of spaces that the portfolio committee is now opening up. What I will do from our side is to actually go back to the union and report to them what has happened here at the portfolio committee. And hopefully we could bring in our national health and safety coordinator. And I don't think this is probably going to be the last of these events, and I'm sure there's going to be more to come. And that the next time around, we are able to come in and give a more kind of substantive account of our experiences in the energy sector. Having said that, I know I'm not going to labor this. I'm just going to say, well, thank you to the committee for giving us this opportunity to come here today and to make this very, very short presentation. And I hope we can... We can actually strengthen our relationships, not just with the committee, but also with the associations that we're here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I missed your name.
It's Woody Arun, and I work with the NUMSA Parliamentary Office here in Cape Town.
Thanks very much, Mr. Arun. Safe to say that I wish your other colleagues from the chemical union as well as the NUM could have been around to share with us as well from their perspectives. But as I say, this is still a journey which we'll have to go, but obviously let's just take note there are a lot of other competing priorities, but we'll try to be innovative in future. Honourable members, we've been listening from morning until now. It's time for us to respond now, questions and comments. Over to you. Honorable Mloto, Honorable Hailing and Smani.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a quick one from my side. One to the Paraffin Association. I just want to establish from them whether they are happy with the design features of some of the stoves that are used for paraffin, or are there any areas of improvement that can be effected to minimize the casualties that you have alluded to? The second one would be to the guests, the LPG Association. I also want to establish whether do you by any means stipulate the standards that must be adhered to by those who fill these gas cylinders and the standards that should be applicable to their sites? And do you conduct periodic investigations or supervisions of the sites? The last one is to ESCOM. Chairperson, I just want to establish from ESCOM whether there's any collaboration between ESCOM and the municipalities in terms of dealing with the issues of illegal connections.
Honourable Fahey.
Thank you, Chair. It's certainly more than a mouthful, as you said. There's a lot of information presented here, and I think that what does encourage me, though, is that there seems to be a bit of a paradigm shift occurring, where this isn't just around kind of household safety, but in fact it's around household energy use. And this is the kind of strategy that we need to move towards. Because I think that people are making choices out there, and a lot of this is driven by economics, particularly in low-income households. And I think we need to be alive to those particular dynamics. And I've just jotted down a few issues here. The Paraffin Safety Association talked a lot about fires and in terms of accidents and ingestion. But there's also issues around indoor air pollution as well, which obviously isn't just from paraffin, but also from wood burning, from coal burning, and that's one of the biggest causes of respiratory conditions in South Africa, and this is an issue that needs to be looked at. So, I think when we look at a household energy strategy, the five kind of things we need to look at is that the problems at the moment is indoor air pollution, fires, economically inefficient choices that are being made by people, as the representative from NIMSA said, that even if you have a connection, what we're finding is that people are actually using other energy sources for cooking and for heating, rather than actually using electricity to do that. So clearly there's an economics issue around this as well. There's also the security of supply. So the LPG gas, I think, is great for cooking. I use it myself. The problem that we're facing, though, is the security of supply and availability. So people aren't always able to get hold of it, and so people are going to go for the easier option. So a household energy strategy would need to look at issues like that if we're going to include LPG gas in that. And then also the high upfront costs, because I think that, you know, a lot of the decisions that households make are economically inefficient at times because they can't afford the high upfront costs. I mean, I think even middle-income households make these choices. So they don't put a soda water heater in because they can't afford the high upfront costs, even though it will be paid back over 2 to 3 years. So this is something we're going to have to address, I think, as well, how we do that. And I was just speaking to my colleague as well. You know, we're spending billions at the moment in rolling out solar water heaters, and 80% of the million target is going to be going to low-income households. So we're prepared to spend billions on solar water heaters, which don't necessarily take the demand off the grid because most of those households don't have electric water heaters either. But maybe what we should be looking at as well is that what kind of funding can we do for other appliances where the need is actually even greater. So hot water isn't the highest need in a low-income household. It's probably more around cooking and it's more around space heating. So how do we look at funding some of the upfront capital costs to get the best appliances in place so that we actually reduce the kinds of accidents and also make sure that people choose the economically efficient option? So these are the kinds of things that we need to look at. I'll be interested to hear comments from all of you as to how we actually address all of those particular things. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. I'm just going to start where Honorable Freyden left off. It's for me, it's bringing down the 26% of energy use, especially around, among the poor, for their paraffin users to an alternative safe energy, and what that is going to be and how we should do that. And if you can do that, and that to me is the million-dollar question. I do think that gas is it, but then we've got to link into some sort of a funding model which becomes a policy decision. But those are the things that we need to look up, and I think that's where the starting blocks must go. I wanted to talk about Eskom towards the loss in the fatality loss. And I must say that your 2010 target is not the same as the ones that are being published on the website. I just take note of it. It's not the same. What are the actual financial loss, or let me say the lost time injury rate and the total recordable injury rate? I'm trying to understand if there is a big impact on your business, and what is that loss maybe on your management, your energy loss of your management, maybe the percentage of that. I'll come back to that one again. Your fatalities that you spoke on, does that include your contractors that is on site or that works on behalf of Eskom products? And how do you monitor actually your contractors in the safety standards, especially if they subcontract to Eskom to do certain programs or activities? Is there in your investigations reports that you manage your risk management, is there a link to certain substations or certain areas of concern within your group, or is it is it very minimal? I'm just want to see if it's mainly at your generating plants, or is it mainly at your you know, on your grid system. On your fatality loss, is it due to skills, or is it or could it be written down to your infrastructure, your quality of your infrastructure, or the equipment that is still being used of? I know that we've got a big backlog on your aging of our infrastructure on your grid, and that's coming to a 45 to 50 year old period. And I'm trying to understand that if those things are a direct cause because of some of the infrastructure that is at a decayed level, which it is, and therefore fixing some of those things leads to some of these circumstances. On the paraffin side, you spoke very little bit on your linkage with SABS, and of course that most of those equipment being used by these end users should be SABS monitored. What is your role in the monitoring of your organization getting or finding equipment that actually doesn't meet those standards? What then? Where do you step in? What are the measures that you put in? You obviously are being funded by the petroleum sector, or you get your money through the petroleum sector through some sort of levy, so I'm not sure how that works. Is it efficient in order to roll out your marketing campaign? I've noticed that you've got four offices, around South Africa, and if I look at the various rural communities, some of those very rural provinces, you probably haven't got access to. You might have a satellite office, but I couldn't determine that. I just would like to see in that, especially in those areas where you are not covered, how do you cover those areas, and how often do you get into those areas where you're not situated in? Are you planning to get into those areas? What is your operational complement looking like? Is there need to build, and what hampers you from building into where you would like to go to? Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, honourable members, for those questions. I'll deal with the stove designs, the first question that honourable member Moloto asked, as well as talk about indoor air pollution and linking it up to SABS as well. Okay. I'd like to talk about SABC as well. But anyway, yes, we have been involved in the development of standards for past couple of years with the SABS. And there are two standards that govern paraffin-fueled appliances, the SANS 1906, which is for non-pressurized stoves and heaters, appliances, as well as SANS 1243, which is governing the pressurized appliances. The regulation from the SANS 1906 came into effect in 2007, VC 9089, which stipulated that before any appliance, non-pressurized appliance, actually reaches the market, they have to go through certain tests. Unfortunately, Since that time, there had only been one product that was passed or was deemed compliant. And even that appliance, we have taken this issue up with the DTI, met with the Minister's office, Minister's staff, as well as we've taken it up with the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, that we're not happy with that particular product from a safety point of view, as well as the lack of compliant appliances coming onto the market. So we do have problems with that. We have, as we mentioned in our presentation, we have done lots of appliance surveillance where we go into communities throughout the country, in most of the provinces, actually check what people are buying. What we found is that most of the appliances that people do have in their homes and those that are in informal settlements, being sold in informal settlements, are actually illegal. We have taken this up with the NRCS, and we've actually gone on joint blitzes in the past where these appliances are confiscated as well as destroyed. So there is a big challenge around getting compliant, efficient, paraffin-fueled appliances to the poorest of the poor. Linking it up with indoor air pollution, yes, we do know that it's a big challenge. We have links with the United Nations initiative, the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves. We also realize that if appliances are truly compliant, one of the tests actually tests for carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide ratios, which also indicates efficient burning of the fuel. So if there are compliant appliances out there, they should actually give very low emissions, which will increase safety and health because of a loading of indoor air pollution. I think I'll hand over to my other colleagues. I think Lonwabo will cover the funding and the reach of the organization. Maybe Glenn can just comment on the cost of energy to the poor, building of new power stations in relation to taking people off the grid and meeting their thermal needs in other ways.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Delani. Thanks, members. We have limited resources. We're not able to reach all the provinces of the country. We've tried to double up, and where we have a staff member, let's say, based in Pretoria, to work also in the northwest area. We have situations where we have a staff member looking after two provinces, what we like Free State and Mpumalanga. What we do is to try and work more on partnership approaches, where we train trainers. Like, for example, we go to departments in those provinces and train the people, and then those departments themselves take up the issue and move forward. We found that model works very well. It's cost effective, but it takes time to build relationships, up front. But we don't have a lot of money. We would like, we are fundraising, going out to fundraise, elsewhere as well, to make sure that we can supplement the resources that we're getting from our current funders. And so we have a challenge out there. That's why we're trying to build these partnerships with as many organizations as possible, so that they can take over some of the costs. For example, in the city of Tshwane, Pretoria, in the past, we used, for example, to provide stationary training materials and things like that, but now we negotiated with them, and they paid for the reproduction of that material, like printing and all those kinds. We're trying to find innovative ways of getting the work done and getting the users to pay for our material, but we don't withhold our materials from being used. So what I'm trying to say is that yes, we have challenges with resources, and we're going to try by all means to expand our sources of funding as possible.
All right. My name is Glenn Truren. I'm going to speak a little bit about the systemic challenges, which I hope will address some of the questions. I think that this is probably the most misunderstood part of the problem, is understanding the need and the solution to that need. A household has a need for information technology, for lighting, for heating, and for cooking. Now, the way that that has been interpreted is that a household needs electricity. And there are a lot of problems around that, and I'd like to just use an example. We did a study in about 2008 where we said, what happens if you were to provide cooking to households with safe paraffin appliances that are top of the range? So we looked at providing appliances at a cost of approximately 1,000 rand each to low-income households or any households with a view to them not using electricity. And if you were to get safe appliances from somewhere like Japan, where they have very high safety standards because of their earthquakes, you could install possibly those appliances in 1 million households within the space of about a year to a year and a half at probably 35% of the cost it would take you to build another coal-fired power station that would be required to generate the same amount of energy during peak energy consumption. Once you turn the first sod of soil, it would take you 7.5 years to get it up and running. So that's just an example of us having to radically rethink systems. It's interesting that we have a challenge where people say that paraffin is a dirty fuel and therefore should be abandoned. And it's actually not the issue. The issue is, how is that fuel burnt? It is possible to even burn coal very cleanly. In fact, there's somebody who's done work in Mongolia where the emissions from the newly designed coal stoves are cleaner than the ambient air that is coming into the stove from the city in question. So one needs to relook at the systems, and this country has a huge opportunity to develop a niche industry of appliances for low-income households and address some of our other socioeconomic challenges at the same time. Indoor air pollution and the requirements of heating. There's some very, very basic, cheap solutions. You can have appliances burning that draw air from outside, and the emissions go outside the home at the same time with some sort of flue or chimney, very basic technology. The way you align households reduce their requirement for heating energy, and you can cook with a simple thing called a hot box and reduce the number of hours that you require to have a naked flame in your household. But you've got to appreciate what's it like to live in a household of 2.5 meters by 2.5 meters with two adults and two children and one door and no windows and the challenges you face to meet those energy needs. So we're hoping that the debate will go away from whether it should be electricity or gas or paraffin, but rather how do we make sure that all of those are both safe and efficiently used across the country. I hope that helps to rethink about that. And obviously, upfront costs are a very big issue for low-income households, but I think that point has been made already. Thank you.
You're done, but I think, okay. Over to LPG.
Thank you, Honourable Chairman. I think the first response is to Honourable Moloto. I think there's two questions there. The first one was, do we stipulate the standards for cylinder filling? And then the second question is in terms of inspections of those filling sites. In terms of the first question, yes, we participate on the South African Bureau of Standards Committee for the two specific standards that deal with cylinder filling of LPG. The first one is South African National Standard 10087 Part 7. Then the second standard is 10087 Part 3. In terms of Part 7, Part 7 particularly deals with the storage and filling of LPG gas cylinders for your smaller gas dealers, like a hardware shop and that kind of thing. And it's filling from a 48 kg size cylinder into a smaller size cylinder, 9 kg or smaller. The second standard, Part 3, deals with bulk filling sites. Now, in terms of both of those, yes, we stipulate some of the technical requirements, and how we do this is in line with the Standards Act requirements in terms of a consensus process. So we ensure that there's industry participation, and it also includes all the other relevant stakeholders, because in terms of the standards, the local authority is also one of the authorities that has to apply those standards as well, in terms of your fire departments as well, etc. The Department of Labor and the Chief Inspector is also one of the authorities that's stipulated in the standard as well. So through that consensus process, we ensure that there's an applicable standard. And second to that is, in terms of liquefied petroleum gas being a hazardous substance and classified as a hazardous substance, it falls under other regulations, so like the Hazardous Substances Act and requirements. So in terms of that, for example, if you have a bulk filling site, there's a number of processes that must follow. So the site itself needs local authority approval, because it's going to be storing a lot of flammable substances there, and it has to show that it has met the requirements. So generally, they will submit plans, and the site assessment will be done. There will be also AIA, an independent inspection authority, approval as well for that site. And then the fire department as well will conduct an inspection of that site. And they'll be issued with a flammable substance certificate. And then that means that periodically, I think every year, there's an inspection conducted. And that would be by the local authority or the fire department. Where we come in terms of the inspections, is we generally come in from a corrective process and in terms of incidents, because we've aligned our processes with CETA, and our particular CETA is the Chemical Industry Education and Training Authority that also has the quality assurance aspect, because we provide training. So we have to measure how is our training, is it being is it effective or not, by assessing if something does go wrong or there is an injury of one of the workers at a filling site, or something's going wrong, what went wrong, are the processes that are detailed in the standard correct, and is our training methodology correct, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where we come in from that perspective. But generally, if there is an incident, not only in a filling site, if there's an incident anywhere, I think this year we've had one major incident in Johannesburg in a shopping mall that involved LPG. There's a number of stakeholders that will actually investigate. You'll have your forensic fire investigations. We assist with the Department of Labor to look at the regulatory side of it. What kind of appliances, piping, hoses, and all of those regulatory aspects to ensure that form of compliance. Obviously, your Department of Labor will also do your occupational health and safety inspections and to ensure that basic conditions of employment and those other aspects are met. So there's a multitude of parties that are involved, and including the fire department. And then effectively, if there is a death, in this incident there wasn't death, there were three injuries, though, your SAPS will also get involved. So, in terms of that, we try to facilitate a platform that we involve industry and all of the relevant stakeholders in the standards process with under the auspices of the South African Bureau of Standards, but then we also get involved in ensuring that those standards are implemented, trained, and you know, in to ensure safety. So I think that's answer that question. The second question from Honorable Khailin, in terms of security of supply, it's a very hot topic in the LP gas industry at present. We were requested last year to attend a briefing at the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Economic Development to discuss issues around LP gas supply and availability. And I guess prior to that and after that, we've been having active engagement with Department of Energy as well on security of supply. And I do believe, I can't talk on the Department of Energy's behalf, but in those engagements, the department is actively reviewing the regulations, reviewing the current status in terms of supply, not only of liquefied petroleum gas, but of other products. But coming to that, I think from a supply perspective, obviously on the short term, there are some challenges because a lot of the major LP gas companies are moving to imports. They're importing a lot because there's an increase in demand as people are looking for alternative energy. But there is a process underway as well for, I believe, a storage facility has been approved in Saldanha, and there's other storage facilities being reviewed. And that is through the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, NERSA, who we've also had interactions with. You know, concerning security of supply as well and availability of storage around LP gas. But with that said, from a global perspective, I was in Qatar last year visiting the extensive oil and gas fields that they have there, and it was reiterated that there's abundance of LP gas in globally. It's very available. It's difficult at times to transport because we've had some incidents with around the coast with the pirating of vessels and things like that. It has impacted slightly. But there is an abundance of LP gas in the world. So, you know, with that in mind, I guess the key role player when it comes to security of supply would be Department of Energy. And National Energy Regulator of South Africa to look at local manufacturing capacity, imports, and local storage capacity going forward. So I'm hoping I've answered that question. Thank you.
That's gone.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just in response to the first question, do we have any collaborative structures or do we work with municipalities? Response is yes. We not only share strategies in terms of theft and illegal connections, but we also undertake similar types of projects to determine technology that will assist us between ourselves and municipalities. At this point in time, I know of two pilots that we're running, one with the city of Cape Town, where they are operating in their Philippi area, which is a high-risk area, where they're testing alarm systems on cable. We're doing a very similar project out in the Palatial area, where we're looking at underground alarm systems for cable theft. We also have a joint committee that meets every quarter. It's part of the safety and security infrastructure, not just nationally, but also provincially, between ourselves, Telkom, municipalities, to look at things like copper theft and illegal connection. So we have structures in place with municipalities. Chair, the second question was around the lost time injury rate, and I want to confirm that this year Eskom has not recorded the total recordable injury rates, but we have recorded the lost time injury rates. Going forward, we will have a recording of the total recordable injury rate. Our LTIR for this year was 0.41 against a target of 0.23, but it was a marked improvement from our previous years. In 2010, our LTIR was 0.54, and in 2011, our LTIR was 0.47. So it has come down significantly.
but not at the rate at which we want it to be. Our target for the coming year is going to be 0.2. Chair, we note that the stats on the web and the stats that we presented are not aligned, but we will be able to explain that as well. Chair, in the numbers that was presented, it was the public fatalities that we addressed. It did not include employee and contractor fatalities. We had 13 Eskom employees that passed away, and we had 12 contractors passed away. What we presented was the public statistics and the public fatalities. But on the question on how do we monitor contractors, I want to go forward and say that not only contractors, but subcontractors working for contractors in Eskom, as part of the tender returnables, they need to produce a generic safety plan. As they take site, they have to give us a site-specific plan. Depending on the size of the project, they are required to have a safety rep on site, a safety officer. If it is a big project, we actually have them with a safety structure as part of the project as well, not just a safety officer. We also have that for the environmental environment as well. We have at least, I said, 4 contractor forums per year in every province with specific focus on safety. They are part of our campaigns in terms of zero harm. They also get our work instructions directly from the provinces and from head office in terms of how to operate. We also determine the standards for personal protective equipment for not only ourselves, but also our contractors and subcontractors. We monitor them by means of direct supervision. We have what we call clerk of works. They go from site to site to check, one, on whether the outputs that we've asked for them to deliver, that they are delivered, and more importantly, to check that the safety standards are met with Eskom. If we find that you do not meet the safety standards, we issue a non-conformance. We immediately stop work on site until you've rectified the situation. We then go back and then issue an instruction to rework. On the question of do reports show any trends in either GX, TX, or the distribution part of the business? Chair, due to the size of the distribution and the customer services part of the business, the risk exposure is much higher. You have roughly, between the two divisions, close on 20,000 people working there, so your risk exposure is higher. If you look at the generation plant, it is within a controlled environment at the power station, much more manageable, much easier, and also the interaction with the public is limited. Transmission, also a smaller amount of people, just under 3,000. The exposure to the public is high in terms of their network, but the staff exposure is much lower because of the numbers. So the bulk of your exposure to both the public and the staff is sitting in your distribution part of the business and your customer services part of the business. There are no specific trends. What we can say is that the theft and vandalism is at the lower end of the value chain, much more on the distribution part of the network than you would see generation. The question around fatalities, is it due to a lack of skill or is it the plant condition? Chair, I can safely say that it is not due to the plant condition. What we have seen, though, is that there is a campaign in Eskom, particularly from senior management, to change the hearts and minds of the people in Eskom. It's really an attitude in terms of safety. We've got standards that compare to those of DuPont, which is a world benchmark. We've had DuPont as part of our partners in terms of safety. So our processes are quite robust. The support structures are quite robust, but it really is a matter of the attitude of the staff and then obviously education of our customers and communities around safety. Thank you.
Can we just add, there was a question on whether we've quantified the financial loss, I think, around energy losses. I think on average, if you take illegal connections and meter bypasses and so forth, Eskom, it's costing us close to about 1.2 billion per annum.
Thank you very much. You know, I wish we could have had the chemical union here and also invited Sapia, because
we haven't spoken anything around the oil industry. There are safety issues as well there. Anyway, you moved at their speed. Oh, by the way, last weekend I had my gas heater on, and it was smelly. Now I'm going to check it because I ended up having a headache. I hope there's no leakage because I've been using it for a couple of years now. I don't know how to start. There are lots of things, but thanks Eskom in particular because they have just reminded me that this is not the first time reference is made to regional stakeholders forum, and I did ask for information, and I made comments on the first or the initial report that I got. The participation or the activities of these regional forums is very erratic from one province to another. I hope we will keep in touch on that, because in my assumption, honorable members, I think I did refer it back to ESCOM to actually indicate, you know, what is happening. I don't remember pretty well the extent to which safety issues were handled there, because it's a wide range of things. And as I say, there's also a lot of unevenness, because in some provinces, you know, municipalities are linked, in some provinces they are not, you know, it's a very haphazard thing. But I'm deliberately provoking it, members, because already it's clear in my mind that that's one of the platforms that actually could enhance participation of various stakeholders around particularly electricity safety, you know, because it's already there and it's working. Department of Energy is here. I know when we invited the department, they said labor is the appropriate department to handle this. I see some heads shaking, so I hope you would join me, Mr. Swart, to either refine, if I put it mildly, or correct that, if I put it bluntly, because it is the Department of Energy that has the responsibility of ensuring, you know, adequate, affordable, and sustained supply of energy in South Africa. Concomitant to that, to me, is also safety. But we have someone who may talk about that. As a writer to that comment, the question is, who then regulates safety? If it's a number of departments, can we be taken to some lecturing? And another thing that came up in my mind was that reference was made to illegal retailers. If they are to be legalized, who does that? And retail licensing, that's from the LPG Association. Can you just be provocative and indicate which appropriate structure is supposed to handle that? And also, as a matter of interest, the LPG Association spoke about illegal activities. I hear them talk about neglect, because sometimes there's neglect. I think Paraffin Safety Association has been very, very, you know, articulate on that. You know, there's a difference, you know, of, you know, accidents caused through illegal activity versus neglect. They may be the same, but there are also different ways of responding to that. I'd like to echo and emphasize the issue of adequacy of funding, as the Honorable Felling has raised, but also check the extent to which the LPG association is either satisfied or not satisfied with that. Of course, let me be preemptive and say there's never enough money. But at least one can sense really from the Paraffin Safety Association, they really need, you know,
as much appropriate resource mobilization as possible. Not just funding, but all forms of resources because of the work and the enormous challenges ahead of them. Let me just run through a few things with questions and comments. Once renewable energy is about producing electricity, I'm sure at some stage, you know, when we continue our journey, we'll have to invite that sector and let them share with us, because birds, even if they are animals, are not immune to the slashing from the turbines, from the blades. There could be a few other things from illegal activities when people want to tamper with the solar panels, and the story goes on. Remember, I want to handle issues comprehensively when it comes to this. I was quite keen about this issue of using children as the conduit to go to parents. Does that mean that parents, if you approach them directly, they are not as responsive? And what methods are you using to really ensure that you do pick that up? Another area is it's good that NUMSA has raised the issue of the intensive energy users, and I trust and hope in future we'll definitely be picking that up very, very strongly, and we'll invite the IEUG. Probably that's one of the most appropriate structures to help us in that. Indoor air pollution, we've got someone from the Department of Health, and I'm sure in future we'll be interacting more with them to see how we really take that up very interestingly. In fact, there's a lot that will come out of that area, the extent to which you know, the existing appliances are less polluting or more polluting. I think for now, let me just get responses so that I can make further, you know, comments. Oh, yes, I just was quite curious, that is the Paraffin Safety Association. In one of your graphs, what I noticed is that it seems the in terms of eight sectors, the bulk of victims of accidents is sort of the young ones, babies and the young ones. A little bit of understanding of why it is there. But then I looked once again in your background. I saw that there's some population of the background around the age range 20 to 34. It strikes. Can you please comment on that? Although I grew in an environment using the primer stove, as we call it, but I'm always shocked when I hear that it exploded. I saw that the stove explosion was quite high as well, and I would have thought it would be causes, you know, would be other areas. Do you mind if you could comment a little bit on that? Why? I can't remember which one now, but it's in one of your. Yeah, it's energy-related fires in South Africa. 32%, which is the highest, followed by candle falling. Oh, yeah, a stove exploded, 32%, followed by candle falling, which is 30%, followed by stove knocked over, which is 21%.
know, that's really quite striking. I was definitely going to ask about partnerships, but as you went along, you made reference to that, but I'm still keen, in fact, to everyone, the effectiveness of those partnerships. It's one thing to have stakeholders forum. It's a nice fashion in South Africa. Let's all come together. Let's work together. We can make it better. But to what extent are such partnerships effective? To what extent do they compensate for resource constraints, for example? I mean, there are other effect areas of effectiveness, the impact of the education and whatever else, but to what extent where they are, these partnerships, you know, are active. Thanks for now. Whoever wants to start, shoot off.
You should start seeing that I'm sitting closer to you. Thank you, Chair. I'll start with a question around the stove explosions or appliance explosions. Our understanding is that a lot of these appliances come to South Africa illegally. They are badly designed. The materials that are used are not proper. Many of them, we checked, for example, on the internet. We saw companies out in China. Exact same replicas of the South African stores that you find on the internet being manufactured there. And they come through South Africa, through our borders and sea and so on. And I remember traveling down to Durban, where we're meeting with the, was it SARS? Yeah, with the managers of SARS. Because we're looking at the ports, just to make sure that the customs officials there are trained to be able to pick up and identify these illegal shipments of paraffin stoves and heaters. And a week after we left, we got word that they had impounded a huge shipment and kept it there for some time. Sometimes what happens is that they are brought in and then they take it, they trucked as if they are going, let's say, to Swaziland or Lesotho or some other place, and then they get dumped into some place and sold out of trucks. These are illegal stoves. They do not meet any of the South African standards. And they are, you know, they are corrosive, they rot quickly, and all of that. So, because people, and they're cheaper, and because people do not have money, they buy them from the local spaza shops and so on. And so what we're finding is that is the reason why these things are exploding. Sometimes the paraffin inside the appliance literally boils. When you touch the thing, it just burns you. There is no technology to keep it cool that's being put in there. Our standards do outline how that manufacturing process has to take place, but unfortunately, since they are coming from outside, that is not taking place. So we have conducted training for customs officials, I think in Durban and East London, if I remember, in Port Elizabeth as well, but we've never sustained it thoroughly because, as I said, of many other things. Just in terms of
see why I was asking the effectiveness of these partnerships.
Yes. Yeah, yes. Sure. It's very important because we are working from a model that says that because we are an NGO with limited resources, we want to sustain the program by getting the relevant stakeholders trained enough to be able to take on the work and sustain it. I remember reading in the, I just hope I'm having this correctly, in the Integrated Energy Plan, that there was the plans for the department to do something on paraffin safety in terms of projects on the ground. But when you looked at the column of budget, there was nothing in the budget. So that's
the department is represented. I hope they'll respond to that.
there was no budget at the time, and I think the department is having a number of competing and a lot of demands on their budget, and we're just hoping that maybe in the next financial year that
that the budget would be put in place. We're in discussions with them to make sure that we do things together on the ground in terms of projects on energy safety awareness and efficiency awareness on the ground. These things we're hoping to achieve. Just in terms of the children, so the 24-year-olds and 34-year-olds, my colleague can answer more, but I was in last year, I was out in a hospital in Temba, Kapogweni in Mpumalanga. What's the town? But Kapogweni is a hospital there. And then we're meeting with the management of the hospital. And we had done a surveillance from that hospital in terms of injuries and reasons for the injuries in that hospital. So we're feeding back to them what we're finding from that hospital. And I remember that one of the things that was raised was that a lot of 24-year-olds, because of poverty and other problems that they're facing, they were using paraffin to attempt suicide. That's how they show up in some of these graphs. So you've got that as well, because people end up in hospital because they were trying to kill themselves for other reasons. It's got nothing to do with the fact that they were using paraffin and they got injured, but they were using it as a poison to sort of kill themselves. Colleagues, I don't know if you want to add more. Okay.
Yeah. I'll just continue in that vein. Yes, it's mainly children that are injured, both by hot water burns as well as paraffin ingestions specifically. But there is a peak in the young adults, I would say, the 2034 group. And one of the questions that we do ask is there any alcohol or drug-related usage linked to that injury? And we're also looking at any sort of gender-based reasons as well. The data, as well as talking to doctors at maybe Doran Ginza in Port Elizabeth, there is definitely a gender-based aspect to it, where paraffin and causing fires are linked to some domestic dispute. An errant husband coming home late and then actually getting paraffin poured over him or even hot water poured over him to settle a relationship challenge. So that is happening. And
putting it mildly.
Yes. Yeah, I don't want to put it any warmly. That is a big problem. It actually paints a picture of what sort of socioeconomic, psychosocial problems are actually existing out there. We've also picked up that many of the ingestions are related to parasuicides, attempted suicides, where mainly women, let's say in the Kimberley area, the data there shows that mainly women are, young women are actually using mainly medications and paraffin to make a statement, and that also linked to other sort of gender-based violence, HIV and AIDS, abuse and so on. So yes, we do see a peak of injuries in that young adult age group. Talking about effective partnerships, I just like to say that yes, it's good that we differentiate between partnerships and effective partnerships. We do have partnerships with the National Disaster Management Center, with Mindset Health, with the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, that's supposed to be finalized soon, and other sorts of partnerships or MOAs that are about to be signed with the West Rand District Municipality, for instance. City of Joburg and City of Tshwane, we've actually trained all the environmental health practitioners. So that I would say those are effective partnerships, because they're actually using our messages, our materials, most of them in all 11 official languages, and actually working directly with community. My last comment would be on why do we work with schools? Is it more effective than working directly with adults in households? We do have a comprehensive, integrated approach when implementing interventions. We do work with schools. We have projects, let's say in KZN, where we reached many students through an essay writing competition over a protracted period. Educators were actually using our materials and within the life orientation lessons actually getting the information out there, getting learners to actually digest and come up with essays around safety. So we do target schools. It's very cost effective. But we also do lots of home visitations, and this is based on research. We have published it in Health Psychology Journal, where the home visitations were proved to be an effective way of getting people not only to increase their knowledge, but also their risk perception, as well as their health, their safety behavior. So what I'm saying is that we do both. We do direct intervention, visiting homes, talking to adults, as well as working with young learners.
Let's just look at time. I know I should have said earlier. If you could just be a bit fast so that you can give us a...
I'll try and be very brief. I think a key issue, and the reason why we appreciate it being here, is that insufficient attention is being paid to address these problems, and yet the cost to the economy is unbelievable. No one looks at the housing developments and says, I'm going to now subtract all the houses that burnt down. This morning on the way here, another 3 children died, I think it was in Soweto, and the commentator said what they always say, the cause as yet is unknown. Yet we know that unless there's an insurance policy involved, there will be no forensic investigation, so no one will really know what went wrong. So it's almost impossible to distinguish crime statistics would be impacted, from actual accidents and injuries due to negligence. So, and if you're in an informal settlement, there's absolutely no way anything will be investigated. In fact, the site will be cleared within an hour. So, it's interesting that Germany, that has 1/3 of the solar energy that we have put in a program in place that has enabled it to be so affordable for people to install solar panels that they now have a surplus of solar energy and they're selling it below cost to surrounding countries. So I think I'm using that point to say that, one of the reasons why children are dying so much and are being injured so much is because, A, most of them are left unattended, because poor people are forced to leave their children unattended. And yet there's also developmental reasons why that age group suffers the most. It's interesting that there is a law in this, there is a standard that says if you sell paraffin in 20 litres or less, it shall be in a appropriately packaged container with the correct labeling and signage and a child-resistant closure. Well, unfortunately, even though the Consumer Protection Act says that people have the right to have anything purchased according to the South African Bureau of Standards, you cannot find packaged paraffin being sold to end users. Unfortunately, those people are buying their paraffin in cool drink bottles and milk bottles. So I think it's a call for a decisive action to put this. I think the problem is that it's not on anyone's agenda, and perhaps the starting point is a household energy policy that looks at safety and efficiency. Thank you.
Okay. If I could move and speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was 3 questions asked. The first was on retail licensing. Who handled this or who's responsible? And I think you requested us to be a bit provocative. The second one was on neglect, and the third question was in terms of funding. So in terms of the first question, retail licensing, the only way I can explain it is maybe to compare it with the Department of Transport, for example. With the Department of Transport, they've put in place conditions for vehicles on the road, so they've set a speed limit. And in terms of that, they've set another condition that if you drive a vehicle in the road, you must be licensed, because it brings in a effective compliance where they have enforcement. You exceeding the speed, they pull you off the road, and then you're either fined or whatever the case may be. So, and that would be the Department of Transport. If I can compare that now to liquefied petroleum gas, we have, for example, retail price regulation that's been instituted by the Department of Energy, but with no licensing, and which impacts the enforcement and compliance aspect. What do you do if you catch somebody that is retailing incorrectly? And whether they're breaching the health and safety, because the Department of Labor will, yes, go with their inspectors and issue a prohibition notice for them to conform, and then that operator will then conform. But the method of training, of trading, is illegal. They're just accessing any other people's products or cylinders or whatever the case may be. So that's a challenge. Second to that, whose role? Is it the Department of Labor or the Department of Energy? I would go back to the motor vehicle perspective. The manufacturing of motor vehicles in the factories and so forth, that safety aspect is governed by Department of Labor and the Occupation Health and Safety Act and Machinery Act and all of those other requirements. But when the vehicle is on the road, it's the responsibility of the Department of Transport, because they create all of those licensing conditions for the vehicle owner. So comparing that back to liquefied petroleum gas, the Department of Energy, as I understand it, licenses manufacture of petroleum products, wholesaling of petroleum products, and with your petrol and diesel, etc., they license even the retailing aspect. So I think it's important that they understand safety is also a requirement, because the fulfillment of those licensing conditions include safety. The operation of those sites should be safe. So hence, if that operator is infringing or not complying to the safety requirements, they put their licensing conditions at risk. And within the petroleum sector, and it includes paraffin and a lot of the players in our sector, safety is very, very important. You know, they never turn a blind eye to safety. I think some operators lose their distribution licenses because they are doing unsafe practices without even looking at their licenses, you know, or taking that up to the Department of Energy. So I think that's the only way I can kind of be provocative around that issue. The second one, in terms of neglect, and I appreciate that comment. We do come across in gas installations that are suffering from neglect, you know, have been neglected. I'd probably say from 2009 onwards, because of the introduction of the pressure equipment regulations, it's changing that playing field very quickly. Because of the incorporation of the health and safety standards, which includes maintenance and all of those aspects, we are finding better compliance and less neglect. But I guess the main issue when it comes to neglect, when it comes to LPG gas cylinders, is where the cylinder owners and importers of the cylinders that bear the responsibility for maintenance can't get access to the cylinders because they've been acquired illegitimately and they can't get them, poses a huge problem. So, you know, we're hoping with the stakeholders we can find a meaningful way to, you know, to clean up the industry and streamline the process when it comes to cylinder handling and maintenance. In terms of funding, just to keep it very brief, our organization, I think we're in a similar position as the Paraffin Safety Association. Our funding is voluntary, so it fluctuates from time to time. We appreciate the funding that we receive from the companies that support us, but we are met with the same challenges, and hence that's why we also deploy a similar strategy of interfacing with stakeholders. We provide training for the Department of Labor inspectors, just specifically around liquefied petroleum gas and those aspects, filling sites and so forth. At all of our training centers, we have positions that are available for the local authority, fire departments as well. It's just a way that we can contribute, but at the same time, it assists our industry by having a more understanding of the challenges that are faced, but also providing training as well to stakeholders. From that aspect, I hope I've covered those three questions. Thank you.
That's all. around safety education, specifically to school children and why not necessarily parents. I think in response to that, we're saying that there's a specific focus to school children, but that does not necessarily mean that we're actually neglecting parents. Like we said, with the pre- and post-electrification safety education, that's where now your parents are actually involved. Before they can actually come into contact with our product, they will have been taken through the safety education. We also have what we call customer forums, where a number of issues are discussed. Safety is also an element that is discussed there. But then, specifically talking to kids, it makes perfect sense, because when we looked at the problem of electricity safety, we found that there's an element of behavioral change that needs to happen there. And then when you look at behavior change, it actually becomes easier to bend it while it's still young. So when kids are still at school, it's easier to actually talk to them and make them understand the challenges. And again, when you look at school children, for an example, when teachers talk to them, it carries much more weight than when parents are talking to them. So school children will come from school and start telling their parents, you know, at school they say we must do this, we must do that, because it's the right thing to do. And then it becomes very effective. The parents also now are actually, they're finding themselves having been educated from both angles. And how we do it, you ask about methods that we use. We actually do what you call train the trainer, where we have been developing material in ESCOM, and then basically teach or train the educators, the school teachers, who will then present it to the learners. But then from time to time, we also have our safety education, safety educators who actually go to school and present the material to the learners themselves. But generally, we believe that if you can actually catch them while they're still young, your chances of success in terms of this behavior change is actually that much enhanced. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I know, albeit that we're a very, very small community today, we're depleted, but it's, to me, we've picked up a lot. It's very, very striking, in fact, you know, that, you know, consideration of safety issues challenges and becomes a catalyst for us to consider a whole host of other issues, you know, affordability, you know, access and the rest. You know, one of the things that comes in mind from Martin Truton, okay, has said, is that look at what government did in smoking. Because the last time I heard that the government spends about 4 billion rands a year on smoke-related diseases. Smoke-related diseases. 4 billion rands a year. So immediately I realized that the government cannot sit down and fold its arms. The same thing with alcohol, you know, alcohol-related accidents everywhere. You know, you may get a little bit begrudging because a couple of drinks a month are dropping because of the increasing in prices. But, you know, flip the other side of the coin and see how much the Department of Health is using, which is the government, is using the taxpayers' money to address alcohol-related accidents and incidents of all sorts. Maybe we should do an engaging link with that. Oh, I almost let the Department of Energy off the hook. I know we're over time, but I don't know whether the Department of Energy would like to say a few words. Sorry about that, Honourable Members. Yes,
that's okay. Good day, colleagues. My name is Landi Temba. I'm from the Department of Energy on the hydrocarbon and energy branch. So
with regard to the issues that have actually been presented concerning, let's say, safety, I would say today I've been put here, been mandated to be on the observer status in order to gather or find out about issues related to energy and linking them to matters of safety. And then we are looking at the issues just from the point of view that our primary concern or high concern could be on nuclear safety. But with what has been actually highlighted on linking the DOE on several issues on safety, like on the issues pertaining to the LPG gas regulation on pricing that we have actually implemented, which initially we know that it was because of the erratic pricing of LPG gas across, let's say, South Africa, whereby you'll find that the 90 kg was 120 times 220 per ton. So these kinds of pricing, which were actually abnormal, led us to ask to try and regulate this price. But I could see that now it has been pointed out by the LPG Gas Association that, you know, we cannot really, let's say, regulate maybe the pricing and let go of the retailing, maybe licensing in terms of covering that. So on that aspect is that I could gather information and actually present it to our principals with regard to that so that they could have a review on the approach to this matter. And the other thing is that we're looking at is that if we define maybe the role of the Department of Energy let's say on scope with regard to safety on these issues, how far do we actually go, and where is the overlapping issues? So I think on the basis of that is that much as you have made a correlation or a comparison of the Department of Labor with issues relating, let's say, to maybe a Department of Transport or Labor with issues relating to the safety of speed limits and us relating it to the issues of retailing of LPG gas. We do also regulate the issues on pricing of petrol and so on. So do we have to cover maybe issues that relate also to the safety on the issues of petrol and petrol stations and all that collectively? So on that aspect, I would say this is the fact-finding information that I will gather and present it to my principals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A little bit of a concern, Honourable Member, isn't it? Because I would have thought that the OE should have been a little bit proactive on this matter. I mean, if NNR was here, yes, we would understand, and looking at nuclear energy safety. But now that we've removed it, it seems we've actually made a little bit of a discovery, which is helpful, you know, because this is one area you cannot undermine. You know, one death too many is painful. And I think up until last night, you know, the TV was covering this little kid who's had a very interesting, you know, surgery. And as someone who spent 6 months in Chris Adebar, I've seen bands. It's not a nice sight in the ward where I was. So I can share the pain, and imagine now when you count, as production safety counts, thousands. So I trust and hope, Landy Temba, really you would impress very strongly on from our side as members that we would like to really get it clear. And other members that we're not going to sit on our laurels. I'll try and get some research inquiry and get someone to indicate or just do some comparison the extent to which Department of Energy to handle energy safety beyond nuclear energy. In closing, quite a number of things have been raised from reviewer of safety regulations,
an appropriate regulatory authority, that is institutional arrangements. A number of departments were raised, and I hope and trust that we'll look at the assessment to the extent of risk and impact from an a comprehensive angle, because it seems up to now we've heard a lot from the paraffin safety. Entertainment. We see TV full of entertainment, but to what extent are we having entertainment? And if you want to give adverts, how much would it cost? Because it's about people's safety. An idea of a comprehensive and intersectoral collaboration has been raised. Hopefully, that would also address the risk of competitive relations, because you don't touch my turf, whereas we see the reason and rationale for a collaborative approach. The impact of on health, the department is around, but also insurance. I trust and hope we'll look into that. Information sharing. Can I appeal to everyone that even if you use newsletters, if you have some electronical, it would be helpful all members to have that information, not to wait until we get another session for briefing, which honestly would be months away because of competing priorities. The issue of free basic electricity to minimize illegal connection as well as enhancing affordability to do this. It links with what Mr. Shoran has said, in various ways. These are the things that honorable members should really be at the forefront of our minds, Another thing that was that struck me is that energy becomes most expensive to the poorest. I mean, with this big event next week in Midrand, I'm sure I'll have a nice Monday to go and do some doing there. But it's important that we really look at how that gets reversed. I know it's not an easy thing, but if research shows that the poorest get hard hit, and this is like energy, but obviously there are other costs as well. Above all, it seems our approach, honorable members, was okay, that we need to ensure that we approach energy safety in a comprehensive way. And I trust and hope by bringing the various players together today, they will exchange business cards, they will ensure that they network even more intensively so that by the time we meet again, we would be able to get a better story on how they are collaborating on the ground to ensure that there are less hazards and there's better safety in the energy sector. Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned.